Troy. Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Another Sunday night in the Motor City, broadcasting all around the world and into the Detroit area. Hey, how you doing? Jolene Jordan off tonight. Oh, what was that old musical? My Fair Lady. I've Grown Accustomed to Your Face is one of the songs that's sung there. So all of a sudden it feels very empty in this room. It's just me. So it's me and you and the almighty Jade. She is our phone screener, co-producer tonight as well. You can reach her, she is the gateway to get on the air at 313-298-WRIF. If you're listening to the first time and you think, wait, what's this guy talking about? I thought Riff was about rock and roll. Well, you know, we got a rock and roll sensibility here on Night Call. But what we do on Sunday nights for 2 hours, we let you phone in, get on the air, give your opinions about, whatever. We're always open line. I introduce topics, and you can respond to those, or you can bring in your own, if you like. So at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Those of you who have been writing me about my website, peterwerby.com, that's W-E-R-B-E.com, and say, what's going on, Pete? The thing is static. Nothing's changing. Well, I don't even want to go into it, but it was all about who was hosting it and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I could not change it for about a week, and so it's a little bit up to date. It's still a lot of work to do on it. Facebook.com/Night Call, and there are podcasts there, and you can also go to WRIF.com and get the podcast. You go to my website, get the podcast. Friends Wanted on Facebook. I have no idea about Facebook. Yeah, I know. I am totally out of it, but be that what it may. I'm in some other things, but not a lot of it online, except for my website and my email address, where you can also write me. Call talk yes at yahoo.com. Call talk yes at yahoo.com. So I have to do all of this tonight, man. This is going to be tough, but we can do it. So I didn't do much this weekend. Went out to dinner, and I was thinking this seemed like another night in the Motor City. Went to a Japanese restaurant and had some sushi, you know, and stuff like that. And you wouldn't know anything out of the ordinary was going on, that there's almost an economic collapse in Europe, that there this huge oil spill is threatening a good section of plant and marine life down south, that there was a Times Square bombing and what have you. But I don't know. I mean, I think that people try to our lives aren't about what is happening on this show. You go, wait a minute. What are you saying here, Pete? This is a special time where we get to think about and talk about the things in the world that affect our lives and affect the rest of the world. The rest of the time, what are we doing? Yeah, we're working, if we're lucky, we're going to school, we're hanging out, we're Facebooking and all that stuff. We're playing sports, we're going to concerts, and if all we thought about was this stuff, man, it would be pretty miserable. But there comes a point where we have to think seriously about this, because there are great forces working upon us that are going to determine what our lives are about. And we can see in different periods in history. I mean, think about the late 18th century. Hello, big revolution, right? And the anti-slavery effort and then the Civil War, all that stuff. So you go right up through American history. There are a lot of periods you don't even hear about, right? Who knows what happened in the late 1870s, right? When else was things? Late 1940s. I mean, there was stuff going on and all that, but not necessarily this earth-shaking stuff. Well, as I say that, I'm thinking about all the parentheses. But in any event, I think, and sometimes you can't even tell till you look back on it, that we're in one of those earth-shaking periods, epochal changes are going to occur. In other words, of an epoch, you know, of this period. We talk about different eras when so much, so many things changed, so many, there was such an alteration in the lives that people led. Sometimes from war. Think about the Civil War. Hundreds of thousands of Americans killed. World War I and World War II. Things that maybe at least in some of our consciousness, like the 1960s or our parents' consciousness or so many different eras that that people were, you know, people didn't say, I don't think they used the phrase the Great Depression, but they knew times were bad. These are bad times. And people scurried for jobs, and a lot of people lived okay. Everybody wasn't unemployed during the Great Depression. Everybody wasn't in a breadline. But still, when we look back and we define that era, it's the Great Depression. Well, you would think, and this could be good news, that the European Union has put together a rescue package of nearly $1 trillion to combat the debt crisis that has engulfed Europe. What happened to those folks? And before you go, oh, man, who cares about that? Look what happened to the Red Wings. Now, that's really bad. Swept 4-1. Yeah. But this is the kind of thing that, I don't know, we're not, that probably isn't on all of our plates or not very many of it. We may have heard about this a little in some headlines. There were all these big demonstrations and even riots in Greece, and wasn't quite clear. You know, don't those Europeans do it? They go out there in big numbers and burn stuff and all that. But maybe it just didn't even click in. Well, it's what it's all about are some of these nations have these huge debts, beginning to sound a little familiar, that are that they could default on, and this could absolutely sink their economy. There's something when the debt becomes a certain percentage of the gross national product. What do they call it? We'll go with the old one, GNP. And it's about 13%, and Greece was at that level. The United States, we're at about 11%. So, you know, that's some difficulty. But anyway, the sliding markets, doubts over their ability to act decisively. The European leaders are now going to provide a huge rescue package of nearly $1 trillion in a sweeping effort to combat the debt crisis that has engulfed Europe and threatened markets around the world. And what they were worried about, I think it's in one of these headlines here. Greek debt woes ripple outward from Asia to U.S. Man, that sounds like a poem, doesn't it? Greek debt woes ripple outward from Asia to U.S. In other words, the fear that began in Athens raced through Europe and finally shook the stock market in the United States, now affecting the broader global economy. And I don't know, do I have your attention yet? You may be thinking, yeah, so what, man? Nothing I can do about it anyway, right? I just hope I can keep eating my sushi and playing racquetball and going to a concert and listening to my CDs and iPod and all that. What can I do? I'm a lone individual. I'm not connected to anything. Even if I wanted to have a big demonstration like they had in Greece, I couldn't do it. And what the hell were they even demonstrating against? That doesn't make a bit of sense, does it? What they said essentially was they don't want to pay for it. They, being the ordinary people, and particularly people organized into unions, because what I just read through this four-page New York Times article about this European Union trillion-dollar bailout for Europe and some of the other EU countries, and it didn't say one word about austerity, because what I just heard on the radio coming in is that one of the things, when particularly the International Monetary Fund is involved in this, again, is they demand austerity on the part of the particular governments. Because what they're doing, essentially, they're going to give these big loans and the government's going to have to pay it back. So where are they going to get the money? Where are they going to get the money? They're not going to get it out of tariffs. They're going to get it out of the hides of the Greek people. And the Greek people are saying, and this hopefully will sound a familiar note, something I've been saying, that the Greek people are saying, we're not going to pay for the mistakes that the banksters, the bankers, it wasn't a slip of the tongue, the banksters, in other words, the bankers, and the politicians made. That the financial system created this mess because of greed, because of ineptitude, because of just the nature of the system itself, and we are the ones that are going to pay. I don't like the sound of this, they're saying. And just like here, why are the people who never did anything except what they were supposed to do? You and I came to work every day, did what we were supposed to do. We were good workers and consumers. And did some of us take out loans that were way above our head? Yeah, but we were told by the banksters, this is okay. It's an what were they called, those principal-free loans or something like that? Interest-only loans, that was it. Same thing. Interest-only loans, you can do it, don't worry. The price of your house, the value of your house is just going to go up and up and up. Okay, we trust you. You're bankers. We didn't know you were banksters, but when it comes down to it, who bears the load? Who then gets thrown out of their job, gets thrown out of their house? What communities suffer? It ain't Richie Rich Kid. It's the ordinary people of this country and increasingly the people of the world. So this is what the Greeks are protesting against. And this is why they're saying we're not going to have these austerity programs. And is this going to come here? And what I heard on the radio as well is they were talking about austerity in a manner that I'm trying to remember the words exactly. People are not going to be able to live like they have previously. We're not going to be able to live like we have previously. In other words, we're not going to be able to go to those rock concerts. We're not going to be able to afford membership in the health clubs so we can play racquetball. We're not going to be able to eat sushi, you know, little piece of raw fish that probably belongs in a Barbie, right, and charging you $6 for it or something. That's all going to go away. This profligate spending that we thought was our reward for working hard is going to go away. I know it was bad for a lot of you even before all this came down, but there was a larger section of the population that thought, hey, these are good times. This works. We're getting the rewards of our hard labor. So, I don't know. I don't know what we are going to do. One of the things that I'm, and I don't mean to, you know, I don't mean to say that all of this is going to solve the problems, but I've been talking a lot, and some of my interviews have been with people that have been involved in the United States Social Forum. And that, I keep telling these folks, it sounds like it's where people are going to meet and date or something like that. But social in terms of the country. You talk about social problems or something like that. So this is a social forum to look at what is happening in this country. Now, it's happening in Detroit, June 22nd to June 26th. And you can go to USSF, like in Frank, USSF2010.org. Boy, see, this is why I need Jalene here. She's off. She is off for the night. So the deal is that either we have to accept whatever we are dealt, or we've got to figure out some way to organize ourselves in a manner that we aren't going to take it. You know, there's some songs about that, right? There, remember on Thursday, the stock market dropped 1,000 points. Because they don't even know why. There was some glitch, as they kept talking about. Stocks plummeted from $40 a stock to a penny a stock. Here's what's going on. The glitch that sent markets tumbling Thursday was years in the making, driven by the rise of computers that transformed stock trading more in the last 20 years than the previous 200. The old system of floor traders, remember that? Guys yelling and all that? I guess they still do some of that. Matching buyers and sellers have been replaced by machines that process trades automatically, speeding the flow of buy and sell orders, but also sometimes facilitating the kind of unexplained volatility that roiled markets on Thursday. James Angel, a professor of finance at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University, said, "We have a market that responds in milliseconds, but the humans monitoring respond in minutes, and unfortunately billions of dollars of damage can occur in the meantime. In recent years, what is known as high-frequency trading, automated buying and selling has taken off and now accounts for 50 to 75% of daily trading volume. At the same time, new electronic exchanges have taken over much of the volume that used to be handled by the New York Stock Exchange. More than 60% of trading in stocks listed on the New York Stock Exchange takes place on separate computerized exchanges." And am I losing you again? Are you thinking, yeah, man, so what? You know, that is some other world. I mean, I'm interested in dating, you know. I'm interested in my car. This is all going to bite you in the butt. I don't mean sounds like I'm saying, young man or young woman, you know, listen up, or you're not. It's going to bite all of us in the butt, except for the, you know, the richy rich kids who always profit, even in times of economic recession and depression. So what's going on here? The stock market increasingly is not, we're talking about a casino. You know, they were talking about casino capitalism, where it's not even about financing stocks so people can, you know, open up new businesses, but rather just the speculative capital. And it's not a casino anymore in the sense, what do you think of when you think of a casino? You think of guys and women playing poker, rolling dice. You say, that's a great analogy. That's what the stock market is, just a big roll of the dice. No, it's not. It's the lowest end of it all, of gambling. It's the slot machines, because you just pull the lever. Or now, I don't even know if anyone's pulling the lever. The levers pull themselves. Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great American, what was he, a transcendentalist, right? Remember him, you know, Henry David Thoreau and the boys and Emerson. He said, I don't know, what was it, 170 years ago, things are in the saddle and ride man. I mean, they didn't even have cars then, right? And he said, things are in the saddle and ride man. Well, this is exactly what's happening now. And this is all about our future. This is all about what kind of job we're going to have. And when these guys are talking about there has to be great austerity, always listen to that word. If you're just interested in music, if you're just interested in sports, if you're just interested in dating or anything like that, and you hear the word, if you're just somewhere along the line, you pass a television and you hear the word austerity, and you go, whoa, wait a minute. I don't understand anything about it. You don't have to understand anything about it. That word austerity means you are in the gun sights of the people that want to solve the economic problems of the world out of your hide and my hide and your parents' hide, or, you know, you, depending, you know. I know everybody, there's people listening here from 14 to 84, so it's a wide range. Or your Social Security. A friend of mine said, hey, you know, he said, might be the last generation coming up that's going to have a guarantee of Social Security and a pension. I said, don't be too sure. Yeah, because they're going to go after all of this stuff. Let's see what else is in here that is of interest. Well, that's enough. But what are some of the other things? Oh, yeah. Maybe you can tell me about this. I got this email that from Yahoo News that listed the 20 most stressed counties, economically stressed counties. In other words, ones that are the most stressed. And it doesn't even quite say what that means, but you get the idea. They're the 20 most economically stressed counties. I guess ones that are doing the worst, have the most unemployment, with populations of at least 25,000. Because, you know, North Dakota and all, they got 800 people in a county. Number one was Imperial County, California. Then it goes in one, two, next two are California, then Nevada, then the next three, four, five are up to seven are California, then Iosco County, Michigan. Number eight most stressed county in the United States. So, well, I don't even know where that is. Is that up north? Iosco, is that around like Big Rapids or something like that? What the hell's going on there? Anybody listening in Iosco County? Then number nine, California. Number 10, Nevada. Number 11 for the 20 most stressed counties, not Wayne County. Bet you thought I was going to say that. Lapeer County. What is up with that? A lot of you out there in Lapeer, are things that bad? Number 12, Sheboygan County. That's up around Sheboygan, Michigan, obviously. So what the hell is going on in those counties? Anybody listening that's from those places and give me a clue what's going on? Well, one of the things, let me see, should I go one more? Yeah, give me some more calls. 313-298-WRIF, where I never have memorized that. What is it? 313-298-9743. Jalene Jordan is off tonight. That's her job to say that. I've been reading this little bit from this article that appeared in March in Forbes of the world's billionaires for 2010, and it lists them all. They do it every year. But I thought what was the most interesting and the most telling was that this line here. Most of the richest people on the planet have seen their fortunes soar in the last year. They didn't say increase. They said soar. So while there is all this economic travail, problems, frightening and threatening economic problems, the absolute richest guys on the planet, they've seen their fortunes soar in the past year. Now, here is some of the things that we can look at. Let me see which is... okay, I just wanted to put these in the right order. In New York City, there's a billionaire who is the mayor. And for all accounts, he's doing pretty good. Michael R. Bloomberg. Also happens to be the eighth richest man in the United States. He has a net worth of $20 billion. And on the other hand, it says, as mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, anticipating deep financial cuts from Albany, that's state capital, plans to cut the number of city teachers by 6,700 to help close a projected $5 billion deficit under his latest budget proposal. Bloomberg also intends to reduce the city's workforce by about 5,000 other workers, mostly through attrition and spread across many different agencies. He has prepared, officials say, to take his budget knife to a host of programs that many residents have come to treasure, closing as many as 75 senior centers, as well as daycare centers and programs for children. So you can say, well, what the hell can the guy do? You know, he's stuck with a $5 billion deficit. And so, I mean, one of the things, I'm always suspicious when Republicans want to lay off unionized workers, because city teachers are, you know, and teachers in general, teachers unions are one of the backbones, both financially in terms of voters and also of poll workers of the Democratic Party. So are all the other unions as well. But there's a $5 billion deficit. How about this as a proposal? Hey, Mike, write a check. That's all. That'd be easy. Just write a damn check. You've got $20 billion. You write a check, dude, everyone's job is saved. The seniors have somewhere to go. The daycare centers can keep accepting kids. Other programs for our children can keep on going. Write a check. They don't think about this. And they don't connect it up that there's this enormous amount of money that flows to the top of the pyramid, where increasingly things get more and more difficult for those at the bottom who are still working their butts off. Here in my industry, the media industry, a lot of rough times, I'll tell you. Let me tell you. And but still, big paydays for people at the top. Remember what I read from Forbes, that the wealthiest people on the planet have seen their fortunes soar in the past year. Top executives at the country's largest media companies continued to reel in multi-million dollar pay packages in 2009, a year of widespread cost-cutting throughout the industry. Now, anybody knows what its cost-cutting means. It means getting rid of workers, so the people there remaining have to do more work, and it also means cutting salaries. It says in several cases, the pay packages to the big shots even increased. At the top of the list is Leslie Moonves. He's the chief executive of CBS. His pay package totaled $43 million. That's what he got, $43 million, more than twice what he made in 2008. Not far behind was Viacom's chief executive, Felipe Dalman, who was paid nearly $34 million, 22% increase. And Sumner Redstone, who controls CBS and Viacom, was paid more than $33 million from the two companies combined. James F. Rita, the founder of a compensation consulting firm, said anyone who reads the business section knows the margins are being squeezed at media companies. That's the little guy and gal, the margins. So the fact that these are huge pay packages makes no sense. At Comcast, two highest paid executives were paid $25 million and $31 million. John G. Stumpf, head of Wells Fargo, was the highest paid financial executive, earning, what a piker, $18.8 million. Lloyd C. Blankfein, the head of Goldman Sachs, made $41 million. Less than a million, he made less than $1 million in 2009. Well, I just added up the Viacom CBS guys. They would make together a total of $110 million. How about this? somebody with a decent heart or a country with decent laws would say, how about we're going to limit, given the times, we're going to limit your compensation to $3.3 million apiece. Oh, man, we're really socking it to the guy. Just imagine that. All they go home with is $3.3 million. Oh, that's a gross, you know, $3.3 million. But if they did that, that would leave $100 million to compensate the people in the trenches, the people that do the day-to-day work, everything from the janitors to the newscasters. You know, or, well, newscasters probably make a lot of money. But you know, the people in do the editing and, you know, all that stuff, the stuff in the trenches. But I don't think they would ever say that. In the meantime, let's see. Have you heard about that Picasso? That an anonymous buyer bought Picasso's nude green leaves and bust, paid $106 million for it at Christie's auction on Tuesday. So while there people are getting laid off in New York City, someone just plunks down $106 million. Well, 0.5. You know, who mentions half a million dollars when you get up to those stratospheric levels, right? And but by the way, if that's out of your league, the house where it of the people that own the painting, who gave it up for sale, you can buy their house for only $25 million, and they say there's not going to be any problem doing that. All right, so anybody from Iosco County, Lapeer County, Sheboygan County listening, why are you among the 20 most economically stressed counties? One more thing. I forgot all about it. I'm sorry. It's Mother's Day, right? Happy Mother's Day. 3298-WRIF. It's just become another Hallmark holiday, right? People wished me Happy Mother's Day. Well, have a Happy Mother's Day. I'm going, well. Okay. The first Mother's Day was proclaimed in 1870 by Julia Ward Howe, and it was a passionate demand for disarmament and peace. God, think about that, right-wingers, baggers out there. You know, I go through this all the time. The Pledge of Allegiance, put together by a socialist. The America the Beautiful, put together by a lesbian. This Land is Your Land, written by a communist. What was the words at the base of the Statue of Liberty, put together by a Jewish poet. Man, they probably want to go home. But the Star-Spangled Banner, written by a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. So now we have the first Mother's Day put together by a woman who gave forth a passionate demand for disarmament and peace. She, Julia Ward Howe, was campaigned for women's rights, anti-slavery, equality, and for world peace. She was also an ardent anti-slavery activist who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic in 1862. You know, sung to the tune of John Brown's Bounty, John Brown's Bounty. All right. Being a mother brings joy as well as changes, as challenges, says this article. The international charity Save the Children has released its 11th annual Mother's Index of the world's best and worst places to be a mother, just in time for Mother's Day, which is still with us for half an hour. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms. The index is based on various indicators of women's and children's health and well-being, including access to education, jobs, and health care for women and children. In this report, Save the Children rated the United States at, not number one, not number two, not number three, four, I don't want to go through it all, number 28 on the list of developed nations behind Croatia, Latvia, Greece, remember Greece, Portugal, and many other countries. Cuba ranked number one on the list of less developed nations, while Afghanistan came in dead last. Cuba's a small nation, it says, stands at number one among less developed nations. 100% of Cuban births are attended by a skilled medical professional. 72% of Cuban women use modern birth control methods, while the average Cuban woman can expect to complete 19 years of formal education. Infant mortality rates in Cuba are lower than in the United States. And how can Cuba do this despite 50 years of blockade and relentless destabilization attempts from the United States? The answer lies with Cuba's, ready, folks? Well, it's not a shock, socialized system that provides education and quality health care for all. When I was in Cuba, I toured what they call a Casa de Orientación a la Mujer y la Familia, the what would you call it, or a guidance house for the women and the families, or women and families. And they, on a block-to-block basis, they take care of women's needs, including when a woman is pregnant. There is like a, what do you call those people, medical aid visits a pregnant woman every single week up till the time of birth. Last week, I interviewed at 1 a.m. Sharon Lerner. She wrote a book called The War on Moms, on Life in a Family Unfriendly Nation. Guess which one she was talking about? She's talking about us, right? And I got this letter from Scott. He's in Stockholm, Sweden. He listens to the podcast of this show. And if you want to check the podcast, you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, in the left column. It'll tell you how to get it. You can sign up for it, and they'll just send it to you when it comes. Jade puts it, stays here late after the show, puts it on the podcast, so it's usually ready by noon. Jeremy puts it on the web, the WRIF website, so thanks to him as well. Here's what Scott writes. I met a Swedish woman, married her, followed her home, and had a family. Back then, we split 9 months of family leave evenly when our son was born. They got 9 months of leave, family leave. They split. 4 years later, we split 12 months of family leave for our daughter. Being a stay-at-home dad with an infant is wonderful, precisely because of the bonding and the insight one gains into both parenting and who that child is. Here, you know, back to work right away. So this is not a family-friendly country. In addition to superb natal care, Sweden also provides neighborhood drop-in centers for new parents to meet, hang out, trade experience, and make friendships that last long into their children's school years. The personal contact builds neighborhoods, says Scott, writing from Stockholm. Then he says, and then there is the universal single-payer health care, honest government, effective worker safety protections, safe food, tough environmental legislation, free college tuition, folks, 5 weeks paid vacation by law, and about 12 holidays, a more egalitarian distribution of wealth, more real influence in company decision-making, and much more. So Scott says, so what else could an Ohio farm boy do except apply for citizenship there and feel a deep sigh of relief to be accepted? Well, you know, I can just move.
If you like Sweden so much, Pete, why don't you go there?
How about if we make some different priorities for this country, take the best of what other countries have, maintaining the best of what we have, and making things that so that there's not suffering, there's not deprivation, there's not economic fear, there's not tens of thousands of people dying in this country from lack of medical care, and on and on. We can do that, but we can't do it if we say, oh, we're number one. And we can't do it if we, by ourselves, I mean, as a single individual. It means that it has to be done together, and that's the big challenge.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
How smart is a smartphone that can't even walk and chew gum at the same time? Well, for that matter, download a song while finding a decent burger joint. Point is, if you need one to run multiple apps simultaneously, it better be the magna cum laude sheer genius of smartphones. Introducing the Droid Incredible by HTC, the next chapter in the Droid saga. It's an amazing app machine, built with the processing power to run all the apps you can download at hyperdrive speeds at the same time. Multitasking and taking names when there's no limit to what what Droid gets. There's no limit to what Droid does.
Check out the new Droid Incredible by HTC, on sale now. Or buy the original Droid by Motorola for $199.99 and get another one free, both after $100 mail-in rebate debit card. Only on America's largest and most reliable 3G network. Visit Verizon Wireless, droiddoes.com/incredible, or call 1-800-2-JOIN-IN. All phones require new 2-year activation on a voice plan with data pack $29.99 or higher. Early termination and other fees apply. Coverage details at VerizonWireless.com.
Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees? Having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
My mom is my hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved. She helps them get out, even when she can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My mom is a firefighter, but the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. Julie Jordan off for the night. Thanks for many of you for sending me this news item. President Obama has chosen Solicitor General Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court, and all the baggers and the regular right-wingers and conservatives will go nuts saying she's a far left-wing liberal. She's nothing of the kind, but so the circus will continue. I want to get to your calls at 313-298-WR. RIF, but I sort of mentioned this before, but let's see, Bozo Wozo writes to calltalkyes@yahoo.com, says, I recently got bumped to the day shift for midnight, so I will greatly miss your show every Sunday until I get to change shifts again next year. It was very convenient to listen while at work. Keep up the good work, Peter. Well, hey, Bozo Wozo, you don't have to miss the show at all. As I said, you can either go to WRIF.com, go to our Facebook page, which is Facebook slash Night Call, and in fact, do that. Become a friend, and you can access the shows from there. Or if you go to WRIF.com, you can go to the podcast, and it'll get sent to you right away. Well, one of the things, boy, I haven't been... You know, when Jolene's here, there's two of us working. But I mentioned that the 20 most stressed counties, economically stressed counties in the United States today are, number 8 was Iosco County, number 11 was Lapeer County, and number 12 was Sheboygan. And I said, what's going on there? So we've got a number of people calling. Here's Brandon from Southgate. Brandon, thanks for joining us. What's happening up there?
Nothing. Right now I'm back home. I have a cabin up in Iosco. It's actually in Hale.
Okay. And that's where Taos is, right?
Yeah, Taos is east of us. Yeah, it's just, I can tell it's a very small town area. It's very rural, so I can understand maybe the farming has something to do with it, but there isn't a whole lot of jobs up there, and there's quite a few people that live up there.
Huh. Well, somewhere. I think someone, let me see. I think someone wrote in. Let me see if I got that up there. Dave writes in, greetings, and answer your question tonight. I happen to be looking up the info today. Sheboygan County has an unemployment rate of 20%. That's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, we it's basically our summer cottage, and we go up there in the fall and winter and hunt. And with all new regulations for DNR, I know quite a bit of businesses are also suffering up there because of the no baiting laws.
Huh.
No one buys the bait anymore because you can't bait for deer season.
You can't even have bait piles, so that now is illegal?
Yep, there's been a total ban on baiting for a couple of years now.
Huh.
And one of the stores we used to do a lot of business with, I mean, we still go there to get groceries and stuff, but we invested quite a bit of money in that kind of stuff, and I know they don't sell that really anymore.
You mean selling like sugar beet and stuff?
Yeah, sugar beets, carrots.
Carrots, yeah. Well, there's way too many deer in the state.
Oh, yeah, there is. And I know it's a pretty bad situation here downriver. I'm from the downriver area. Not too long ago, one of my friends got hit by a deer, totaled his car and everything.
I hit a deer, geez, just outside of Ann Arbor, near totaled my car, about $3,000 worth of damage. One of the antlers came through the driver's side window, but there wasn't anybody with me. So, yeah. All right, Brandon, thanks for that info. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. We got another one here. Steve from New Baltimore. It's got some information about the counties up north. What's happening, Steve?
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to make one comment before I go on to the deal about how poor the people are up there in the counties up north.
Uh-huh.
One thing is, you had mentioned about CEOs, how much they make.
Right.
I read a book. It was by Patrick Buchanan. And
sorry.
He had a statement in there.
Yeah.
He said that the average CEO made 22 times the average hourly pay what they make in a year.
Yeah.
And over the years, it's been increasing by leaps and bounds. And the average CEO now makes roughly 250 to 300 times wage that the hourly makes.
Mm-hmm.
You okay,
know,
now.
You know, by the way, let me just interrupt to say, like I was reading about Sweden, where they have CEOs, they got, you know, automobile companies, and those guys make in the upper hundreds of thousands. They make $700,000 to $800,000 a year. And I'll bet you, there's everyone listening, including, I don't know, how about you, Steve, that you and I, if we were making $700,000, $800,000 a year, we could probably get every single thing we wanted in the world, eh?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But back on about the counties.
Yeah.
Your last caller was very, very right on about the deal about not selling bait. I got two cabins up in Ogama, and there's been a couple of things that I've noticed. Now, they used to say that that was the poorest county in lower Michigan, Ogama County.
Uh-huh.
That's up south of West Branch just a little bit. And the problem that we've seen up there is that because the baiting ban has been on, people that like to take off work and go hunting up there, well, now they just don't have weeks and weeks to go up there to scout out deer. If they're not going to get put bait down, their chances of getting a deer have been reduced dramatically. So the tourism dollar has dropped a lot.
So deer,
the other thing,
I was going to say, deer camp is a thing of the past.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's getting that way. And there's just, the place is just getting overrun with deer.
I know.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing is that the tax base that they have up there, when the infrastructure is kind of collapsed around the Tri-County area,
mm-hmm.
people have been taking buyouts and moving up to their cabins up north.
Okay.
So it's stressed the local infrastructure up there with, for instance, with my two cabins, I have to pay garbage pickup for both. I only put garbage out there two weeks in a year. Now people are moving up there, and because they've moved up there, now they can homestead. They can sell their house here, and their taxes drop because they homestead. I have to pay much higher taxes than my neighbors do up there because I homestead here in New Baltimore.
Yeah, it's actually the opposite. When you have new buyers paying less, that's something. All right, Steve, thanks for the info. I appreciate it. Wonderful country up there. I go up to Iosco County, up to Taos, do cross-country skiing. All right, here's Ben in Iosco itself. This is, I didn't even know there was a city called that. Welcome, Ben. You're on the air.
How you doing? Yeah, I'm from Alcona, which is just the county just north of Iosco.
I see it says city. So there's not a city called Iosco?
No, I think there actually is a city called Iosco, but it's also the county.
Okay. Go ahead. What's up?
There's actually a number of problems in Iosco. It started probably, like, I think, 15 years ago. It had Fort Smith Air Force Base closed down.
Oh.
And that's a lot of the people who lived in Iosco worked for the Air Force Base. And since it's closed down, you know, business has slowly been closing and closing because that was, you know, the life of the city or the life of the county. More recently, there's problems like the other customer, other people mentioned, you know, with hunting people not going up there. You know, a lot of people had cabins up there that live down the city, but now if they're unemployed, they can't afford, you know, to go up there and keep these cabins. Another problem, a lot of the good jobs around there would be, like, my dad works for Oakland County Road Commission, my mom's a 911 dispatcher. Both of those would be good jobs for the area, and they're getting a lot less government funding, so they have been kind of laying off, cutting back workers there, too, as well as the schools. You know, those are kind of the good jobs up there, and they're going away because of government not having enough money to support it.
Yikes. It's all just spiraling downward. That's not good. All right, Ben, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Hey, one of the things, I talked about some about this last week, that, you know, the teabaggers, they're saying, we're being taxed to death, you know, too much taxes. They even wanted to be taxed enough already, right? Well, here, this is from the Detroit Free Press yesterday. Yeah, we're still talking about yesterday. Saturday, amid all the bad economic news in Michigan of lost jobs, falling home values, and rising costs for college tuition, at least one item isn't weighing as heavily on the family checkbook. The Senate Fiscal Agency says Michigan residents are seeing a smaller percentage of their personal income go to state taxes. So these baggers are just out of their gourd. Yeah, it says in a recent report that tax burdens have fallen significantly in the state between 1999 and 2009. So, hey, baggers, bag it, will you, when you start talking about the taxes? Michigan residents are seeing a smaller percentage of their personal income go to state taxes. Well, what about the national? Well, you know, that's what we care about. Well, you wouldn't know it by the tax day rhetoric, says this article in the Associated Press, but Americans are paying lower taxes this year, even with increases passed by many states to balance their budget. Congress cut individual federal taxes for this year by $173 billion shortly after President Barack Obama took office. 90% of Americans got this. Former President George W. Bush tax cuts expire in January. And let's see. So anyway, we're paying less tax. There's a whole lot more about it. So, hey, baggers, bag it, will you? All right, let me hang on the line, 313-298-WRI. I want to mention one other thing. So we're talking about things that happen that we're not responsible for, that the elites, either political elites or economic elites, and usually the political elites are acting in the interests of the economic elites. Oh, that's pretty radical, huh? But you never suspected that. That this attempted car bombing in New York City. And I think I did last week, that my wife and I had been in New York City the week and a half before that. And we were right in that spot where that car bomb was parked. Right? Right there. So this is a subject of great interest to me. I have relatives there. I have a great number of friends. In fact, we actually couldn't even see all of the people. I mean, why do Detroiters keep moving to New York? Move, come on, guys, gals, come on back. You know, this city would be much better off with all of you back here. But that's another story. But anyway, so I worry about them. I worry about my relatives. So this is not just an abstract question. But let me see if I can put this in the right order. They now feel, according to Eric Holder, the head of the Justice Department, that the attack was carried out at the behest of the Pakistan Taliban. In fact, the Pakistani Taliban leader, Haqqani Mullah Massoud, has vowed to attack major U.S. cities in two purported new videos released months after he was reported to have been killed by a U.S. missile strike. The videos emerged after the attempted car bombing in New York City, for which his faction claimed responsibility, provided the most substantial evidence so far that he survived the U.S. attempt on his life. I guess so. He says, Massoud says, the time is very near when our Fedayeen will attack the American states in their major cities. This is very frightening, because even though most of us don't go to New York regularly, we also live in a major city, right? And although the people that seem to be most affected by the call to attack the United States using the concept of jihad are of Muslim faith, they represent an extraordinarily infinitesimal number over the overall number of Muslim people in the world, and certainly even in this country. But, you know, if you start getting one half of 1% of people willing to do something, they can do a lot of damage. But let's see. When where is the one I was looking for? Well, here's what's going on, though. This is today. Suspected U.S. missiles killed 10 people in a militant-controlled region close to the Afghan border Sunday, the first such strike since an alleged Pakistani-trained extremist was accused of a failed Times Square attack. Now, why is, you know, I don't like to be attacked by anyone. There's never a reason or a justification for killing civilians. Everybody's got reasons. You know, whether it's collateral damage, or it's purposeful genocide, or they just got in the way, or we didn't intend to do it, or they were hiding among, you know, all these excuses that wind up with innocent men, women, children, and seniors, the elders of a country wind up dead. The United States killed 3 million Indochinese civilians, where we lost close to 60,000. I mean, think of the difference there. And none of it was intentional, even though it was half of a genocide, if we think of the attempt to eliminate purposefully European Jewry during World War II. 3 million is an amazing amount of people. The United States has been fighting these wars in Asia for a long, long time. And always it's the civilians that wind up with suffering the worst damage. And when we kill people at an increased rate, as we've been hearing, at checkpoints, or just they're in a city, or wherever, or that a drone attack killed people at a wedding instead. There's great apologies from the United States forces, and I'm sure sincere. I mean, I can't imagine that there's been some rogues that actually, that assassinated civilians, executed civilians, and some of them were tried over in Iraq. But mostly this is not what the United States military wants to do. I assume once people in the military see what they've done, it's probably something they'll never forget. But we are over in Asia bombing their cities. Guess what they think is legitimate to do? Bomb our cities in retaliation. I mean, we say we're at war. You know, they used to call during World War II, when there were bombing raids over Germany, English papers would say, successful terror raid over Hamburg. If you're familiar at all with what the incineration of the city of Hamburg, creating these firestorms storms by Allied bombers. Terror bombing. They didn't make any bones about it. That's what they call it. Hundreds of thousands of civilians, German civilians, were killed in a night, including American prisoners, British prisoners there, including anti-Nazi partisans and what have you. They just, kill them all at God, sort them out. This is another reason to oppose this war in Afghanistan, that we have gone over to people's country, waged war against them, for a reason that escapes me. The reason is that the Taliban government gave the Al-Qaeda a place where they could attack the United States. Al-Qaeda was way out in the mountains. Wasn't they like they had a downtown office in Kabul or something like that? The idea was pretty much, to, particularly by the Bush administration, to overthrow the Taliban and put in a government that was extraordinarily sympathetic to the United States and its oil interests, its pipeline interests. That's what it's all about. And now Obama's just trapped in it. I mean, what's he going to do? Quote, lose the war? Like Nixon and Ford lost the war, where they had to, you know, just get out ignominiously, the last helicopter leaving Saigon 35 years ago or so. So in the meantime, if we keep waging war against people in Asia, it sounds like they say they're going to wage war against us. Here, Pakistani-trained extremist. I wonder what the people think whose cities in Afghanistan are being bombed, the weddings are being destroyed, the people in cars that are being killed at checkpoints by our troops, our sons and daughters and fathers and uncles and neighbors and what have you. I wonder if they consider the people that do that to be American-trained extremists. You know? But they wonder, why in the world is our soldiers from Michigan and Ohio and Texas over here bombing our country? Because most of them don't even know about all this stuff at all. It's not some unified deal. I mean, they don't hate us because of our freedoms, as that moron president before Obama said. They hate us because we're in the Middle East. They hate us because we're in South Asia, in Central Asia. What do you think? 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
How smart is a smartphone that can't even walk and chew gum at the same time? Or for that matter, download a song while finding a decent burger joint? Point is, if you need one to run multiple apps simultaneously, it better be the magna cum laude sheer genius of smartphones. Introducing the Droid Incredible by HTC, the next chapter in the Droid saga. It's an amazing app machine, built with the processing power to run all the apps you can download at hyperdrive speeds at the same time. Multitasking and taking names. When there's no limit to what Droid gets, there's no limit to what Droid does.
Check out the new Droid Incredible by HTC, on sale now. Or buy the original Droid by Motorola for $199.99 and get another one free, both after $100 mail-in rebate debit card. Only on America's largest and most reliable 3G network. Visit Verizon Wireless, droiddoes.com/incredible, or call 1-800-2-JOIN-IN. All phones require new 2-year activation on a voice plan with data pack $29.99 or higher. Early termination and other fees apply. Coverage details at VerizonWireless.com.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debt for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
The Motor City's premier celebration of bikes, babes, and rock and roll is back. Motor City Harley-Davidson's Harley Fest 2010, presented by 101 WRIF, Saturday, June 19th at Northville Community Park, located at 5 Mile and Beck Road. Mark your calendars for the biggest gathering of bikes, bands, beer, and babes, happening June 19th at Northville Community Park. Enjoy great food, cold brews, and live music from Detroit's best local bands. Shop for great merchandise in the
Vendor Village. There will be a ride to Harley Fest that morning, leaving from Motor City Harley-Davidson. It's for a great cause, benefiting the Rainbow Connection. We'll see you in Northville, Saturday, June 19th, for the 12th annual Motor City Harley-Davidson Harley Fest. Get the details now at WRIF.com. Brought to you by Motor City Harley-Davidson. Feel the freedom at the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. Miller Lite, taste greatness, and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
Do people sometimes describe you as a saver, a bit frugal, penny-wise, and somewhat thrifty?
You know, cheap.
If that sounds like you, you're going to love the newest addition to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Coupon crazy!
At MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, you'll still find great gift certificates for local businesses with goods and services on sale for more than half off. Find money-saving online coupons that you can download right now and start saving immediately. Log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and save big.
With online coupons from Autolab USA, with over 20 locations in the Metro Detroit area and a 12,000-mile, 12-month warranty. Hagopian Rug Care Center with 5 locations in Metro Detroit. They're the leader in carpet, rug, furniture, and tile cleaning.
If you're looking for ways to enjoy life and stay within your budget, then go
coupon crazy
now at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. That's MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. Your online home for great ways to save big at local Michigan businesses.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Jolene is off tonight, and here's Jim Morrison.
You cannot petition the Lord with
well, some people think you can, Jim. But here, a couple of items having to do with religion. The White House has dropped an archaic phrase that has in the past rankled Jewish groups. The use of the proclamation boilerplate in the Year of Our Lord for a celebration of Jewish Heritage Month has struck a slightly off-key note for Jewish groups in Obama's last proclamation, as those of Bill Clinton and George W. Bush did. So this year, the phrase has been replaced by the simple phrase in the year 2010. Steve Freeman, an official at the Anti-Defamation League, said, let's see, this was good. But regardless of the phrase employed, the year is still calculated from the birth of Christ after all, says, who's this, Ben Smith at Politico. But they have something else that you can do, like I would never say, A.D., right? A.D. is Anno Domini, right? The year of the Lord, you'd use C.E., which is Common Era. So this is 2010 CE, Common Era. And, or you can have BCE, stands for Before the Common Era. Because it's a little ethnocentric, right? Just to have AD and BC. But that's when it dates from. You know, in the French Revolution in 1789, they started the calendar over. That was, 1789 was year one. But let's see. When government regulators shut down Integrity Bank at the height of the recession in August of 2008, the bank was seen as just another failed lender that had overvalued the real estate market and collapsed. But on Friday, a federal indictment was unsealed, accusing two former vice presidents of the bank of hastening its downfall by selling fraudulent loans to a hotel developer in exchange for bribes, about $80 million worth. The bank was founded on Christian principles in 2000 in an Atlanta suburb. Integrity used the model, the motto, In God We Trust. Yeah, well, the bank gave customers free Bibles and employees prayed together at meetings. And that's P-R-A-Y, not P-R-E-Y. One-time investors included a Georgia state senator and the former CNN host Lou Dobbs. But in announcing the indictment, the United States Attorney Sally Yates said Mr. Ballard and Mr. Foster, the indicted bankers, had not lived up to the bank's name or mission. Do you think? Here's what's going on here. You think, why am I attacking religion so often? It's these religious hypocrites. The really deeply religious people that have their own private faith and go about doing good work in the world, either by themselves or with peace and social justice groups or in their church, you don't hear about them. They're not making a big deal. They're not intervening in political and financial affairs. This is where the hypocrisy comes about, right? We were talking last week about evangelist Franklin Graham, the son of Billy. He prayed on a sidewalk outside the Pentagon because his invitation to a prayer service inside was withdrawn because of comments that he had repeatedly used and insulted Islam. So he went into the parking lot with a half a dozen friends, formed a circle, and prayed with heads bowed for about 5 minutes. I guess they prayed to the Lord, right? Get rid of these guys. Have you ever heard of the Shrine of Turin? That is this, what is it? It's a linen sheet that has the faint image of a bearded man that some people believe is the shroud of Jesus that he was put in after he was brought down from the cross. Why that would mark him or mark the cloth is way beyond me. But 10 years after the shroud last went on display, nearly 2 million people have made reservations for a timed glimpse of the religious object. You get 5 minutes on weekdays, 3 on weekends, depending on the bookings. And there's a labyrinthine line that can take well over an hour. I guess you can bring your cell phone and do photos. For most of them, the bearded man is Jesus Christ, and the 14-foot, 3-inch by 3-foot, 7-inch linen cloth now encased in a bulletproof frame is his burial shroud, one of the most venerated and contentious relics of Christendom. There's all sorts of relics. You know, they have bones. I mean, this is spooky as far as I'm concerned. I'm sorry if I'm stepping on any toes, but I got to say that. I mean, having bones of saints and what have you, and they have reliquaries, isn't they? Yeah, the reliquaries they have. Let's see here. Shroud skeptics call on a shopping list of evidence to refute that it's authentic, including traces of paint pigments and carbon-14 dating tests carried out in 1988 that led 3 independent laboratories to date the cloth between 1220 and 1390 CE. Or what was it? I can't remember what it was. Was it CE? Was that what it was? Contemporary era? Current era? I've lost it. Never mind. Here it is. Wait a minute. The CE Common Era. Yeah. So it's it doesn't go back to that. These people all say it's a fake, but they have these things. You're gonna think I'm making this up, but there is a reliquary that contains the holy prepuce. That's P-R-E-P-U-C-E. Prepuce. It sounds wrong the way I'm saying prepuce. What it is, it's the foreskin of Jesus, and it's contained in a reliquary. At various points in history, a number of churches in Europe claim to possess Jesus' foreskin, sometimes at the same time. By Jewish religious law, boys are circumcised on the 8th day following their birth, a ceremony marking them as Jewish, which a lot of Christians don't like the face, but he was. In the Christian calendar, based on scriptural telling of the event, the Feast of the Circumcision of Christ is celebrated on January 1st, the octave day of the Feast of the Birth of Christ. And if you can go, I actually got this out of Wikipedia. So you can go to Wikipedia and put in Holy Foreskin. Absolutely weird. We were talking last week about what's that document the baggers are always talking about? The U.S. Constitution. They want to get back to the Constitution. But anytime you start you know, put it up there, they go, woo. First Amendment to the Constitution, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. And on April 15th, District Judge Barbara Crabb ruled the National Day of Prayer unconstitutional. And that left-winger president of ours, Barack Obama, he said, the hell with the court's decision, we're going ahead with it. And he prayed and got some other people and prayed, too. The suit was brought by the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. They're from Madison, Wisconsin. And let's see. And what, may you ask, is the National Day of Prayer? This is from the Nation magazine Catholic column. Pardon me. Subject to Debate, which is the name of her column. Like under God in the Pledge of Allegiance and in God We Trust in our dollar bills, the National Day of Prayer may sound like it goes back to the days of wigs and three-cornered hats, but it's actually a product of 1950s anti-communism, back when communism was usually modified by godless, because he said, you godless communists. Billy Graham pushed for it in ways to promote the Lord Jesus Christ. So they wanted this bill in the National Day of Prayer so that they could promote the Lord Jesus Christ, even though the Constitution says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Let's see here. Also, Senator Absalom Robertson, who's the father of Reverend Pat Robertson, introduced it in the Senate, citing, quote, the corrosive forces of communism, which seek simultaneously to destroy our democratic way of life and the faith in an almighty God on which it is based. In 1952, President Truman signed the public law, which directs the president to set aside and proclaim pardon me, a suitable day each year other than a Sunday as a national day of prayer, on which the people of the United States may turn to God in prayer and meditation at churches. It's kind of exclusive, isn't it? There's only one group of people that does stuff at churches. That's one religion, right? That excludes everybody else, all the tens of millions of non-believers and all that. And it's always been a Christian thing. For decades, the National Day of Prayer has been firmly in the grip of Focus on the Family, this far-right-wing group. And that's what it's all about. This is all about far-right-wing politics. That's how it began, and that's how it has continued. And no president has dared to, has dared to say differently. It's chaired by Shirley Dobson, wife of the Focus on the Family founder, James Dobson. And how Christian is it? In 2005, the Hindu American Foundation sought to join in and said no. All right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dan in Rockwood. Dan, thanks for your patience.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I just got a little question. It's nothing about politics or nothing, but
that's okay.
Now, my cousin has been going through a rough time, and he'd been married for 10 years, and they finally got a divorce. And they have two kids, one's 8 and one's about 5, and my little cousin Jesse just had his first communion today. And so
yeah,
they've been fighting and all that, and my two little cousins can't take it, and every time Jesse hears something about it, it's just, he starts breaking out, and he starts getting sick and stuff. And so then...
It's tough on kids.
Yeah, and then the hard part is, my cousin Lisa, her side of the family cannot stand Jason's family no more, and especially him.
So where's this all going, though? What's up? What's the question?
Well, the question is, what would you do if your wife kept spending money and everything, and kept spending, running and out and all that, and then you find out that your husband is out with another woman, but then it seems like that he's trying to get back at her for spending so much money.
Well, Dan, I'll tell you, I can understand politics some. I can understand economics a little. Personal problems, particularly from other people, of other people's problems, and being told by one side of it, it's way beyond me. They got to get somebody to intervene, and sometimes people won't do that. They need. I mean, that's why I hear these ads. It used to be that people used to think that divorce lawyers made things worse. But I was listening to an ad that we were running on one of our stations today, that where they were saying, "Man, trying to do it yourself and not getting the proper legal." settlements of all of this is it puts you in worse trouble. But I'm sure people got horror stories about lawyers intervening. It's just miserable. I don't know what to say. But I'm sorry it's all happening in your family. It must be a real source of unhappiness to everybody involved. Really hard on the kids. In fact, now that I think of it, some friends of mine are just going through that. And phew, what a story. All right. Thanks and sorry, Dan. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here's Derek in Madison Heights. Hi, Derek.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, listen, first-time caller. You got so much stuff you want to talk about tonight.
Sure.
I wish I had a case of beer and a couple large pizzas and sit down and talk about it.
Well, yeah. Man, don't say pizza. I just think, man. Go ahead.
Anyways, my comment is about the Amero. Do you think the reason why the dollar has been deflated over the years is to compete with the euro? Like, the euro is a little bit more, it seems, in monetary value than the dollar.
Yeah. It used to be at about 85 cents, and then it was up to like $1.50, the euro compared to the dollar. So it was, it was really tough on us. I mean, you know, Derek, I said I know a little about economics. That is also confusing. How can different currencies represent different values? I mean, the money is an abstraction, right? It represents exchange value. So, I mean, how can something cost the same thing cost one thing here and another thing in Canada and another thing in Italy? I mean, it's insane, actually.
Because when I was younger, it was like 30 cents on a dollar.
Right.
And it's a lost value. Mexico, like, where they got the peso, that's like almost more than a buck now.
No.
Okay. Okay,
peso.
A little exaggerated.
Yeah, peso's down the drain.
I know. Yeah. But anyways, that was my comment about the Amero. And do you think they'll come up with something like that to compete with the euro?
What, the Amero, did you say?
Yeah, did you hear that? It's a new currency.
No. That's just nutty right-wing stuff. There's no Amero. There's no North American Union. I mean, there's certainly not. I mean, the idea to sell this, the idea that these right-wingers got this nutty thing that Bush and Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, and the President of Mexico all got together and secretly are planning for the North American Union, and they're going to issue a currency, a common currency called the Amero. It absolutely doesn't have a bit of truth to it. And if anyone was even thinking of it, that maybe this would help us out. I mean, the other two countries of North America, you know, we're all in North America. Canada and the United States is not going to have any economic union with Mexico now that we've destroyed their economy through NAFTA. So no Amero, no North American Union. But thank you. A lot of people believe it. All right. Thanks a lot. How did that name get changed somehow while I was talking? Anyway, let's see. Here is Troy. Troy's in Macomb Township. Hi, Troy. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Hey, I apologize. I didn't log on until a little later, but you were talking about, you were complaining about a company with the majority of workers making too much money?
No. The CEOs.
Okay, the CEOs. So I guess my question is, other than God himself or the next best thing in your opinion, Peter Werbe, who dictates what somebody should make?
Well, you can have social policy. One can decide that happens all the time by any number of different forces. I mean, up until the Kennedy administration, when he began to roll back the taxes on the wealthy, that there were huge taxes on the wealthy, both to provide income for the country that then would be redistributed to the states for the services that the government doles out, and also for the military. And I don't know. So, I mean, we at one point said, well, the market can determine what a employer can pay a worker, for instance. And then we said, no, there's got to be a minimum wage and all sorts of rules on how income essentially is distributed. I guess when you have a situation because of the nature of within capitalism of monopolization, you wind up with this pyramid that gets steeper and steeper and steeper to the point now, if democracy isn't completely eroded by the capacity of the wealthy to determine policy that benefits themselves, a small little 1% of the population, and screws the vast majority of other people, it is close at hand. So the more you allow wealth to accrue in these obscene amounts while other people are going through, trash barrels for returnable bottles, you don't have much of a democracy.
No, but in my opinion, so democracy, how you dictate the wealth of others, is that a democracy?
Well, I don't. Yeah, I mean, you can vote on that. You can vote that all income over $3 million is taxed at 90%. There you go.
Well,
what's wrong with that?
I don't see the incentive to do better for yourself.
Yeah, I tell you, I got to tell you, Troy, I wouldn't get out of bed if I could only make $3 million. Right? It really would kill anybody's incentive. I don't know if you'd missed part of it earlier. In countries like Sweden, other countries like that in Northern Europe that really take care of the citizenry, that people understand that there are a huge community where you don't have these vast tens of million or huge percentage of your population that are poor, where people are denied medical care, where roads suck and all of that. You have really high taxes on the upper class. In fact, you have high taxes on almost everyone. But you get free college tuition, complete medical plans. You get 5 weeks paid vacation. You get, family leave. You get, that seems to be worth to the CEOs that in Sweden make $700,000-$800,000 a year. Imagine that. Instead of making $43 million, they only get $700,000. Or do you think that would inhibit your incentive as well if you could only make $700,000 a year?
All right. Well, you might come me off after this, but Peter, to make $3 million a year, you're going to have to work more than 4 or 5 hours on a Sunday night. But one other thing I had to say, and you,
I have. Well, let me tell you this: I have no aspirations for that because, as a matter of fact, being close to God, as you indicated just a second ago, I am completely and totally affluent. Can you imagine that?
Well, no, and that's a great thing.
Yeah. Do you know what that means, though?
No, that's not a bad thing.
What does it mean to be affluent?
As am I. I am completely affluent as well.
Because what? Why are you affluent?
But I had one other thing I wanted to
say. Well, wait. Why? I say I'm affluent, you say you're affluent. You usually mean, what do you mean you're affluent?
Well, I'm affluent. I'm actually in the category you spoke of.
Oh, well, I am far, 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 far below that. I mean, I have everything I want. That's what I mean. I don't want anything. I got a small inheritance recently. I don't know why this is the age of the public confessional, right? Of $6,000. And if you're in that top 1%, you might be carrying that around, well, on your wrist as a wristwatch. But so I sat down and I thought, what am I going to do with $6,000? I couldn't think of a single thing to do with it. So I put some of it in the bank. I made some charity donations. That was it. I got everything I want.
No, and I do as well without being taxed 90%. But my other point was, as far as the war goes, and I am an avid Republican, but I did vote for Obama.
Yeah. Well, you're not that much of an avid Republican.
No, because I am anti-war.
Yeah, okay.
But so why? He's adding troops now, Peter. Why are we not home now?
I don't. What?
You talked about because he doesn't want to lose, quote, lose the war.
Right.
He's not going to lose the war. Come on now. He was anti-war. He promised to bring the troops home. We're adding troops.
Right.
It's crazy to me. And I have never voted Democrat in my life until Barack.
And that doesn't encourage you very much to do it again, does it?
No, not at all.
Well, I think that the Democrats and Barack Obama ought to listen to this. Because one thing, they're losing their base. We're always talking about the base. The true blue Democratic base voted for him because they thought this was not going to be a continuation of George W. Bush's policy. That when he talked about peace in Afghanistan. But I think he's been told that, hey, if you pull back from Afghanistan, You're going to be seen as a weak president. If anything happens after that, like any domestic terrorism, they're going to say, the Republicans are going to jump on it and say, see, you set this up because of your surrender to this implacable enemy that wants our destruction, and on like that. So, Obama's approval ratings going down, people think, oh, everybody's switching to the Republicans. Well, they would see you, Troy, as someone who says they don't think he's doing a good job because of that, and they would also include me in that would say the similar thing. All right, I got to move on. Thank you, though. Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling, and thanks for having an open mind. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Off to the Twin Cities in St. Paul, Minnesota. Here's Tom. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good evening, Peter. How are you?
Doing good.
You have a tough couple of calls there going every which way from divorce to... Now, never mind.
Yeah.
I'm calling just because I think that there's two issues that are just at the base of every one of these other issues, and one is money that... just like we have the greatest military power, we have the greatest monetary power, and our government is not controlling our monetary power. The monetary power is controlling our government, and we got to get money out of politics. We have to pay for our elections, so the power is in the people, and the only way that the politicians can get power is to please the people. And
yeah,
so the people need to pay for the politics.
Well, the other thing that could happen would be like in Britain, not have these year and a half long presidential campaigns, but rather you could make laws saying this. Well, I don't know if he could make a law that might be against freedom of speech, but to delineate the period of presidential campaigning to like 2 months, and you have three debates. Boom, then go vote and have,
That goes to my second point, and the other one is complexity, that you were talking about currency, and there's something that's incredibly complex, and people make all kinds of money just trading currencies,
yeah.
You know, I mean, just swapping things around.
Yeah, what did you buy? I bought money. What did you buy money with? Money. Oh, yeah, that's weird. That's very weird.
This is built up artificial complexity. You know, it's just another form of a shell game to keep 99% of the population totally oblivious to what's going on. And, you know, our whole electoral process is a whole lot more complicated than it needs to be. It could be quite much, you know, much more simple. But there's advantages to be, you know, people, scoundrels hide under complexity. And
yes, life can be very, very simple, and it is simple for most of us. And most of us, even though this doesn't include everybody, most of us have a family, go to work, come home, have certain pursuits of enjoyment, buy things, have activities with friends, and that's it. And that's usually enough for most of us and can provide a full life. I know some people aren't employed, some people don't have family, some people are suffering really bad stuff. But even if you're in that latter category, that's what you aspire to. When you start hearing stuff, as Tom is saying, that within politics that you don't understand, and particularly within the economic system, things like in the stock market, all this exotic instruments and all that, there's something, that's the bell that tells you something is inherently wrong and you are a sheep to be fleeced. And a lot of people realize that and then say, well, I don't know, there's nothing I can do. I'm just hoping, so I always say, you got, you know, that maybe this set of elites will do me better than the other ones. This set of elites, the Republican elites, will do better for me than the Democrat elites. I think the Democratic elites will do a little better than the Republican elites for the majority of people, but not enough to get me very excited. What we really need is a different system, as Tom is indicating, where people's allegiance, where the financial sectors and the business sectors and the political sectors have an allegiance to all of us. I mean, the idea was under the original, what did you say, theories of capitalism, Adam Smith, that by each seeking one's own gain, it would the whole community would benefit. Well, it hasn't turned out to be like that at all. As I said, the process is always towards monopolization, and it comes out in a moral quality of greed. And you think, why in the hell would anybody even submit to accepting $43 million when the pay being cut of other people in the country, and the company. But I mean, there are moral and ethical qualities to it, but that's really not the issue. The issue is the structure of it and what is permitted socially. All right, Tom, thanks a lot for being on the broadcast.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Win big at the casino?
Nope, better than that. I just got a great deal at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Ah, yes, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, the online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses.
I always look there first. They're the best bet for online coupons and discounts.
This week, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com is featuring Jay's Auto Detailing in Southfield, Premier Pet Supply in Beverly Hills, House of Watch Bands in Southfield, and Gilbert's Pro Hardware in St. Clair Shores.
Jackpot! Nobody beats MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Deal yourself a winning hand. Save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your own home when you connect to amazing deals like these and more at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Do you want a wireless laptop but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronix Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronix is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees, having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
Detroit's Rock Station, 101 WRIF.
The Riff.
My dad is my hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. He helps them get out, even when he can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My dad is a firefighter, but the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
Yes.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Jolene.
All right, thank you very much. It's Peter minus Jolene. She'll be back next week. Our number is 313-298-WRIF. Emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If you've been going to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, it hasn't changed in about a week. Had some problems with the server or the host, whatever the hell. I don't understand that stuff. Anyway, it's back up. Also, we have a Facebook page, just facebook.com/nightcall. Friends wanted. We'll have a podcast available at noon today, which is Monday. And, pardon me, let's see, at 1 a.m., I'll be airing an interview I did earlier. It says on my website here, ever think you're being watched? Well, you are, says Maureen Webb, who's written Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. Following that, it's Bill Morgan. He's written a book called The Typewriter is Holy, The Complete Uncensored History of the Beat Generation. Remember the Beats? People are getting interested in them again. One of the things I've been urging people to attend is the United States Social Forum. You can go to USSF, like in Frank, 2010.org, or it's on my website as well. And there's going to be an event on Friday, May 21st, 5 p.m., at Central Methodist United Church at Grand Circus Park and Woodward on the fourth floor. And it's for youth involvement and leadership development. And these are the kind of things where I was saying earlier, if you're all by yourself, you're an absolute individual, well, you can have effect on people. Best thing you can do is be a good person to people around you. But in terms of having a political impact on the world, we have to be organized. And this is the kind of thing that the whole United States Social Forum, for young people, this would be something really important to go to. So if you missed what I was saying, it's USSF2010.org. That'll tell you all about it. Okay, let's continue on. Well, I can't wait to hear this one. Here's Cody in South Lyon. Cody, hi, you're on the air.
Jesus Christ, never waited this long to request a damn song.
Well, what'd you want to hear?
Well, what, the song?
No, I'm only kidding. Go ahead.
Oh, all right, damn. Well, earlier you guys were talking about Jesus and all that other stuff, how people requested get time or something to see the cloth where his face or something
right.
was, I forget.
Right. Yeah, the Shroud of Turin in Italy.
Yeah, now, see, they say that they took a test on it, that it's not real.
Right.
Some things should just be, like, left unknown and everything, and also how some churches claim that they have the foreskin of Jesus, which I think is really screwed up. Now, wouldn't, like, that rod decay or sometime after all that time? I mean, good Lord.
Good Lord. Indeed. Well, actually, if you go to Wikipedia and you put in holy foreskin, it'll tell you the whole story, how it was preserved and everything. It is really kind of nuts. And if you're just tuning in and saying, what in the hell are we talking about? That they keep it in a reliquary, so they keep relics in this, and it was saved as the holy foreskin, and a number of churches in Europe claimed to possess it, some of them at the same time, and it was venerated, and it was the feast of the circumcision of Christ. So wouldn't it have deteriorated? You would think so. But you know what, Cody? I absolutely agree with you. The whoever was controlling it, I don't know whether it was the Vatican or who, but they submitted it to these scientific tests, and the fact that they said no, this thing is about was from like 1300 or so. It didn't matter to the millions of people that venerated it anyway, and they're working off a different deal. I mean, faith is over here, science is over here, and never the twain shall meet. So I agree with you, but you can look up Wikipedia. It'll tell you about preservation. All right, thank you. 313-298-WRIF. This got to be the only show, not only in certainly in Detroit, but in the country, that would talk about this. Here's Chris in Detroit. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Pete.
Hey, how you
How's
doing?
How's it going?
Going well. Going good.
long-time caller, first-time listener. And here, look, I came to talk about the healthcare reform now.
Sure, sure.
Now, tell me here, what do you think about it?
Well, why don't we go the other way around? What do you think about it?
Can't stand it.
How come?
Can't stand me throwing money out there to the government for them to give some bum, you know, a ham sandwich so he can feel better.
What the hell are you talking about? What does ham sandwiches and bums have to do with healthcare reform?
I'm talking about my hard-earned dollar going towards someone, you know, who isn't putting forth to society.
You mean that we would cover people that are uncovered? So, like,
exactly.
So you mean like some woman whose husband died or left her and she's got three kids? Screw them.
You know, it's not her problem is not mine. My problem is mine.
And well, you rank low on the compassion scale, Chris.
You know, compassion only goes so far, you know.
Well, no, it doesn't. It goes absolutely incredibly far. And without it, with a society without compassion, isn't a society worth its name. And the kind of attitude that I hear frequently like that, that's aimed always at the people below you, never the people above you, is one that really I would say is the ethical failing of the kind of ideas that have percolated out of this society. Don't really want to talk about it anymore, to tell you the truth. Good luck. I hope you never get sick, pal, because then it'll just be your damn problem. Here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, welcome to the broadcast.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Now, do you think a store has the right to refuse service to people to wear them baggy pants?
That what?
To wear them pants down to their butt, you know.
Oh, that are sagging.
Yeah.
I don't know. Don't tell me. You were sagging, Maurice, and they would.
No. It's a store. It's a guy, he's the manager of a store out of Lakeside. He was telling me he got a sign up there refusing people service to have on baggy pants below their waist.
You know, I just don't even know. Because, well, there's certain things, you know, no shirt, no shoes, no service. I never understood. What if somebody came in to a store and they were barefoot? They say, it's a health issue. That's BS. Or no shirt on. And so why can't they come in a store and buy a pop? Or why can't they, if you were in a restaurant and someone came in just in shorts, would you care? Are you with me?
They was clean.
That's what I mean. I mean, if I was at the most expensive restaurant in Detroit and somebody came in just with a pair of cut-off Levi shorts, I'd say, whatever. I mean, who cares? People, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, bars say no colors. You know, you can't have, like, gang colors or motorcycle colors on, or you can't have camo and all that. I don't know. You know, you can't discriminate on the basis of race or religion or gender or anything like that. Sexual orientation. No, I know you can't discriminate for sexual orientation. But maybe some store owners or bar owners, can you say you can't come in if you're wearing camos, or you can't come in if you're wearing shorts, or you can't come in if you're not wearing a tie? One time I went to, when I was in my 20s, I went to a place in Brooklyn that was a famous steak place. And I didn't have a sport coat, and so I had to wear one of those little jackets that the waiters wear. Now I don't know if I think I said this on the air. I stayed at a very, very, very expensive hotel in New York City when my wife and I were there, but it cost me next to nothing because I had a relative that was one of the managers there. So I was there with all the swells that were paying $650, $850, $1,250 a night for rooms. And most of the men, some of them were wearing those $2,000 suits and all of that, but most of the men were wearing, just like I was, wearing Levi's, a shirt with the tails out. That used to really be sloppy. Now it's fashionable. And kind of a little bit, you know, 2-3 day beard. So we all looked just like, I mean, you couldn't tell any difference between me and them, you know, like 10 years ago, if I would have looked at it like that, they probably would have thrown me out for being like a bum, like Chris said. But now the styles are changing. So I don't know. And maybe we can get some other comments on it. But as usual, Maurice, thank you, and I'll tell Jalene hello for you. All right, let's see. Here is Kevin. Kevin's in Auburn Hills. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Good.
You know, there's something that's been bugging me, and I've talked to so many people about it, but nobody can give me a straight answer. And this concerns, you know, the former Detroit mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick.
Right.
Now, he has admitted to hiding away millions of dollars.
Well, not, I don't. Has it been millions? I don't know.
I think it was. I thought the figure was $4 million.
Really? Well, he hasn't reported the income he has, and he's probably going to go back behind bars. That's for sure.
Well, you know, I sure hope so, because he's got people bailing him out. He had fundraising going on for him, yeah. And my question is, where's this going to end? He's got people who, the people of Detroit, who as a demographic are very poor.
Right.
They're putting their hard earned money, or, you know, government money into him.
You mean to have
where's
to
that money going?
Mean having to prosecute him and all that. Well, what doesn't he owe $1 million? So I don't understand it. If he, I actually haven't followed, believe it or not, I have not followed it that closely. Just, and he says, I just saw this quote for him. He said, the people of Detroit have to move on. Well, they can move on a lot easier if he would, settle up. And I don't know how much he had. If he has $4 million, why doesn't he write a check and there's all the restitution? But, what a pain. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it, Kevin. Let's see. I should start moving through these because we're getting towards the end of the broadcast. Going to remember at 1 a.m. Eastern time, be getting an interview on about surveillance, what it all means in this society, and also the Beat Generation. The beat goes on. Here is Brad. Brad's in Ypsilanti. Brad, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Pete?
Good.
I think it was about 3 weeks ago you had brought up an issue on guns and the rebel flag.
We were talking about the Confederate flag, yeah.
Right, sir. You had referred to, I think, Americans who had supported the rebel flag were traitors to the country.
The Southerners were, in fact, the biggest traitors and caused the most damage, more than the Nazis, more than the Japanese, more than the Germans in World War I, more than, you know, jillions more than Al-Qaeda, and violated the principles of the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation, indivisible, right?
Absolutely, okay, but now as we have progressed into the year 2010,
right,
and racial differences have kind of subsided to some degree,
right,
you see more people of different races holding hands.
Sure.
Do you see people getting along with one another? So don't you think that through the history of the Confederacy has brought people together?
Well, I don't know. I'm always a little suspicious, particularly when Southerners fly it. Also, someone flying that flag wounded my great-great-granddaddy, so I'll never forgive him for that. All right, Brad, thanks. Going to move on here. Let's see. Here is Eric. Eric's in Ypsilanti. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hey, Pete. How's it going?
Going good.
That's good. I didn't mean to scare you like a month or so ago about there are some good Republicans. There are, to me. But the way am I feeling, I'm kind of upset with this administration.
Yeah.
There's more union representation in the government than in the private sector.
That's right.
That's the problem. Like, why is there?
Well, there's been a concerted campaign by employers, mostly by figuring this is, you know, the free market that the conservatives love so well. So our labor goes into the free market pool, and it's much cheaper to buy labor in other countries where they don't have unions, or the unions can't provide the standard of living that's competitive with ours. So they go, hey, why pay somebody $18 an hour when we can pay them $1.80 an hour, even though it just totally screws them up, and it's like living in the, you know, the 18 50s or 60s or something like that. So, I mean, that's it. I mean, the government and the unions 50 years ago should have, when that process started, they should have just put their foot down right there. Hey, you know, this is our community, this is our states, this is our nation, and we're not going to let you send us all down to the bottom by going abroad and exploiting labor. I mean, that's what the unions attempted to do, was stop the exploitation of labor with terrible working conditions, terrible pay, terrible benefits, long hours, unsafe conditions. Now, all of that, along with the jobs, has been exported overseas. So they're back like 150 years ago. I mean, here are parents and grandparents and great-great-grandparents and back there, if they were in the union movements, fought, got shot down in the streets of Detroit and Chicago and in mining camps that were fired upon by the National Guard and killed women and children in encampments and rounded up union people in Arizona. I mean, the history of the suppression, the attempt to suppress unions is so violent. The reaction of the employers who use cops and National Guard and private detectives and the prison system, all that. And we finally got to a point where the working class could enter the middle class by all the sacrifices, and that's all tumbling down the drain. And all those conditions that are inherent in the nature of capitalism come now to rest in foreign countries, and we're starting our downward trickle. Pretty soon, hey, we say maybe we shouldn't have a minimum wage. You know, if we only paid people $1.75 an hour, then you know, wouldn't be competitive in Mexico. And maybe, you know, if we let people work 12 hours a day again. Hundreds of people got killed because workers wanted an 8-hour day. You know, on like that. All right, Eric, thank you. Appreciate it. That's my opinion. Here's Rayshawn in Detroit. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, wait, Peter. Hey, this is Rayshawn. I just want to ask you about the immigration laws, what you really think about it and how they're supposed to go about it. That's all I want to know.
You mean the one in Arizona, the new one?
Yes.
Well, even there's an Arizona sheriff that's suing, saying, you know, he can't do that. The only way he could do it would be to, you know, racially profile. Look for, they say, what do you, ooh, a guy's speaking Spanish, and he looks a little dark. We better, you know, bust him up, see whether he's got his papers. Well, turns out, of course, great numbers of American citizens speak Spanish, some of them as their first language. And you can do that here. There's just been a state representative in Michigan that wants to introduce a bill that would allow or order the police in Michigan to do the same thing. So, you know, they stopped you and they said, hey, Rayshawn, how can you prove you're a citizen? I don't know. I can't prove. Actually, I have a passport, but I don't have it with me. And sometimes, man, guess what? I walk down the street and I don't have any identification with me. I don't have to have it all the time. You know, if I'm just doing a walk or something like that. So, you know, they could say, hey, maybe this guy is an illegal Canadian immigrant or something like that, or an Irish or English guy. So what we got to do is work to get rid of NAFTA. That's that law that has destroyed the American, it's done damage to the American economy, but to the Mexican economy, which has driven everybody up here. That's step one. And then work out something that's equitable under the law to deal with these millions of people that are already here and have become crucial to our economy. All right, got to go. Got one more call, and then I can do two. Troy. Troy is in Sterling Heights. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I actually wanted to ask you, have you ever heard of this conspiracy theory called loose change?
Yeah.
I just want to know what you thought about, or if you even believe anything that...
I don't believe, you know, some parts of it, that what they suggest is correct. I mean, you know, that phrase I use frequently, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? If it says it's 10 after 1, it'll be right twice a day. I mean, all all the information is right out there. We're run by an economic and philosophical, it's an interesting slip, a political elite. Wish we were run by, not wish we were run by any elites. But no, that road leads nowhere. But one of the things, Troy, that happens, and it's so bad about it, if the conspiracy is that vast, that all-powerful, it says essentially there's no way in the world that we can fight back. And that's really a bad idea, because we, the American people, have fought back all throughout our history. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. One final quick call from Kim in Holland. Go ahead, Kim. You're on the air.
I just wanted to comment to that guy that called earlier about he didn't like his taxes going to pay for health care.
Yeah.
Well, he probably doesn't pay that much in taxes, so he can just pretend that his are going for a predator drone or something, or subsidized oil that makes him feel better.
Well, that's, you know what? Sometimes I think some of you folks ought to do the show instead of me, because, yeah, that's exactly, I mean, I was talking about it in general terms. Remember I said they're always, the guys like that with no compassion are always willing to criticize people that are worse off than them, but are never willing to point that criticism up the hierarchy. And you using those specific examples, I think, hits it right on the head. I mean, we got $550 trillion a year, million dollars a year, going for the official war budget, and it's really more like a trillion. And that's where the money's going, right?
Yeah.
I get an email from some guy who says, "Oh, people with a bridge card are coming in here and, you know, and taking advantage of it." Well, they very well may be, but that's not where the big bucks are going. That's for sure.
Okay.
All right, Kim. Thanks for being our last caller. Are you calling all the way from the other side of Michigan?
No. It's Highland.
Oh, Highland. It says Holland here. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Highland.
Okay.
Sorry. All right. You have a great night. Thank you so much. Jalene Jordan will be back with me next week. Stay tuned. A couple of very interesting interviews. My website again, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And is there surveillance going on? You betcha, as someone says. And what does it do to our democracy? Then Bill Morgan on the Beat Generation. That's all ahead on Night Call.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Do you know someone who always seems well-connected? Here's your chance to one-up that person and then some. Welcome to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, your online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses. Simply log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com for special online coupons and discounts you can't get anywhere else. This week's featured deals: Jay's Auto Detailing in Southfield, Premier Pet Supply in Beverly Hills, House of Watchbands in Southfield, and Gilbert's Pro Hardware in St. Clair Shores. All you have to do is visit MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. You'll save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your computer. Heck, you don't even have to get dressed. No shirt, no shoes, no problem.
Shop naked, man. Yeah!
Dressed or not, just go to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and you'll be connected to these incredible deals and more. MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, man. Hey, like, this chair is really cold.
Dressed or not, just go to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and you'll be connected to these incredible deals and more. MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debt for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
WRIF NWRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Now, thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Boy, the world gets scarier and scarier every single day, doesn't it? I think it was like April 25th or so, I was in New York City and I walked up to Times Square. My wife and I and two friends did, and we were directly in the spot where that van was parked, that SUV that contained the explosives that fortunately did not go off. So all of this is very real to me, even if I hadn't been there. What we've seen both in this country and around the world in terms of terrorism and what have you is enough to frighten any of us. One of the ways that governments have always responded, both in the technological age that we're in now, but also throughout history, is to spy on those who might be the potential perpetrators. Of course, now with technology, there's an enormous potential for looking at more and more of us. Well, does this contain a problem, a difficulty for a democracy and for civil liberties? Joining me is Maureen Webb. She's a human rights lawyer and activist. She's a litigator for some of the first constitutional cases heard under Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And she was involved in a case challenging the powers of Canada's newly instituted spy agency. She's a co-chair of the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group. She's also the coordinator for security and human rights issues for Lawyers' Rights Watch Canada. We're reaching her in Canada, in Ottawa, in her office. Maureen Webb, welcome to the Peter Werby Show, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Peter.
And I'd be remiss in not saying that you are the author of the book, Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. Well, the ordinary citizen feels, whether it's the economy or oil spills or mine disasters, that the world is rapidly spinning out of control, and we as an individual, even as a community, probably have little effect on all of this. Means people plotting stuff against us in Pakistan, perhaps. So I think we're anxious to have the government protect us. You question, though, whether this all works.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand that that feeling of a need for protection in difficult and newly dangerous times. I actually was living in New York City when the attacks of 2001 happened. I had a little baby and a small girl, and we were on the route where the postal route that the anthrax attacks happened. So I can certainly understand the feeling that you want your government to do whatever it can to.
This is very real to you, then, as it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, mine was writ small. Yours was writ large.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, I, as a Canadian, we don't face quite the same risks that you're facing right now. But as I say, I can understand them in a visceral way because I was living there at the time. But my book is really about talking about what things really do make us safe and what things are perhaps a more hysterical reaction to the situation we find ourselves in and ultimately may be counterproductive. And in particular, I talk about the move since 9/11 to pervasive systems of surveillance, which are designed to track entire populations and monitor them continuously, so that, you know, all of us now are being treated as potential suspects. And whether that mass surveillance, which creates, you know, just masses and masses of information, actually is helping to make us safer, or in fact obscuring the sort of critical information that police and security intelligence should be paying attention to.
Well, they certainly didn't have a heads up on the Times Square would-be bomber, did they?
No. However, you know, the sort of mass surveillance initiatives that I've talked about weren't going to flag him either. You know, in the end, what averted tragedy was the alertness of an individual citizen who, you know, a local street vendor who, in fact, himself was Muslim, and he was quick thinking and called the police, and it was the action of a citizen that brought the bomb squad there.
How could they have 82 cameras in
Times
Square?
Well, conversely, you know, apparently they had 82 cameras in sort of a six-block radius around Times Square, and after they were alerted to this vehicle, they started to sift through the masses of camera, you know, video footage, and they focused initially on a 40-year-old man who was seen walking away from Times Square. He had a red T-shirt on, and they spent quite a lot of time spinning their wheels looking for him as a person of interest, when in fact it turned out that he was quite irrelevant. And what came as the real break in the case happened through ordinary, you know, clues and ordinary police work, where they looked under the car, they found the registration number of the car, they tracked the owner, and the owner was a young woman who had recently sold the vehicle in cash to the suspect, and happened to have an email with his cell phone number in it. And in addition, the suspect had left his house key in the car. So, you know, these were ordinary clues and, you know, just gumshoe police work that, you know, that were critical in the case.
Well, Maureen Webb, one of the things that you get from popular culture, like movies and television programs, is the almost omnipotence and the omniscience of the, you know, the all-powerful and the all-seeing ability of technology. Like, as soon as you put in Maureen Webb or Peter Werby, it's and there's our whole history. And this seems so much more efficient than a 3x5 card system, or get, you know, Joey the Rat to tell us what he's heard on the street. So I think when, and we haven't really gotten to what you would like to see, or how dangerous you may or may not think surveillance is of modern technology, but I think people are learning through popular culture, this stuff works. This has got a bead on everybody, right?
Yeah. Well, what is that Tom Cruise movie where they can the law enforcement can foresee crimes before they happen? They can foresee the it's not The Matrix, the name escapes me, but people know about it, and of course, you know, the Hollywood version is flawless, but the real world version simply doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can tell just from the government's own admissions. Take the no-fly list. In 2005, there were 30,000 innocent people who were wrongly stopped by the list because their names resembled people on the list. And the list itself has, by all reports, anywhere from 44,000 names on it. That was a figure given by 60 Minutes, the news program 60 Minutes, from a leaked document to 1 million names, which the ACLU believes is the truer number. And, of course, you know, many of these people include peace activists. You know, whether you agree with their politics or not, America is supposed to be a free country where free speech and freedom of association are highly valued. And you know, it's known that this not only is this list flagging people in error, but it's also being used to suppress dissent, to target people for their political views rather than they're having done anything wrong.
Well, we know during periods of wartime, if we look at particularly World War I, but World War II as well, dissent is suppressed in the case of the United States, well, and Canada during World War II. Nationals of Canadian and American citizens, pardon me, citizens were put in concentration camps. So there are draconian methods used out of a sense of safety, and we realize now that it was a real injustice to what was done to Japanese Americans and Japanese Canadians. Yet at the time, people valued security way over civil liberties or even people's freedom.
Mm-hmm. Well, and look at the United States just after 9/11. People were rounded up on, immigration charges of all kinds and deported under the NSEERS program. Something like 13,000 people were deported, all men between the ages of 16 and 65, I think it was, and in some cases just gutting communities. And in fact, I think in Michigan, there is a large community of people from countries of Muslim origin.
And the Middle East particularly, yeah.
Right, uh-huh, sure. Yeah. And some of these communities were completely gutted. And, think about what that does, not only to you as your image as a free country, but it also alienates and purges the very communities that you need human intelligence from.
Mm-hmm.
Really good policing and good security intelligence happens when you can infiltrate the communities where people have information about potential risks. And that's what you forego when you, treat the whole community as a dire threat.
Potential criminals. Sure. Maureen Webb is my guest in the Peter Werby Show. Her book is Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post 9/11 World. It's published by City Lights. You can go to citylights.com or at my website. We'll have a link as well. Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E .com. I think you're speaking eloquently. I'm not 100% sure. I'm not in anyone's mind who's listening that you're selling it, excuse the verb, completely. That is to say, I suspect that when Euro-Americans in the 1940s, early 1940s, after Pearl Harbor, was said, we're rounding up all the Japanese because they're potentially a threat. I mean, who was really a threat, of course, were the German-Americans. Those were the ones that were involved in espionage. The Japanese never were. But so there's obviously racism there, and there was a lot of racism when it came to attacks on the Detroit's Middle Eastern community as well. But a lot of people are might have heard you say about disrupting the community and what have you, and said, "Too bad, I don't want anything like that to happen again, let alone here in our area."
But think about where you're putting your efforts. With a lot of these knee-jerk reactions, not only the sort of mass deportation of people, but also the creation of these, giant systems of mass surveillance, you're acting in a blanket way. You're not acting in a smart way. And the smart thing is use traditional methods to get real, concrete, human intelligence about what's happening in certain circles. Look at the underwear bomber. His parents reported him to the embassy in their country, to the U.S. embassy in their country, and the State Department had these reports that he was a risk. These reports got completely lost in the system because of the masses of information that's coming in through automated systems that are diverting people, diverting law enforcement and security intelligence, rather than allowing them to hone in on real risks.
Maureen Webb, tell us either from your book, Illusions of Security, or from other sources. How vast is the surveillance system? You know, the old movies, again, there'd be a guy in the apartment building with headphones on, or a little later, maybe in the 70s, sitting outside of your apartment in a truck. I mean, it's not like that anymore, is it?
Well, it's somewhat worse because everybody is being monitored all the time, not just suspected bad guys or it's a lot more like the Stasi in Germany, where there's a dossier being kept on, a lifetime dossier being kept on everyone all the time now. And to sort of break it down into a simple picture, what's being done is first governments are attempting to register populations biometrically so that they have what they view as a more reliable identifier, so that each person can be identified as a unique individual. Then they are collecting, like never before, information on all of us, linking it together in ways that it's never been linked. And finally, they are data mining that information so that I don't know if your listeners know what data mining is. It's the use of complex computer algorithms that sort through masses of data for specified criteria. And, of course, the criteria are secret, and they flag individuals as potential risks. So, in other words, not only are we being monitored all the time and information being collected on us continuously, but that information is being data mined to predict who among us might be a risk to the state. And you can imagine in that kind of system, they're not really interested in accuracy.
Well, so in other words, if a teenager writes to someone else or on Facebook or email, says, the concert was the bomb, meaning it was good. So that might send a...
Well, in fact, that's a real story. That actually happened.
Really?
Where a teenager was flagged in that way. You could be given, assigned so many points for traveling too much or traveling to certain countries or coming from a certain area of the United States or knowing certain languages, or and you can also see that in this there's also a lot of racial and religious profiling going on.
Well, in my case, I've been to Cuba several times as a journalist. American citizens can't go, and I've been to Venezuela. So does that mean they maybe they're listening to this call? I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you, our call right now.
Yeah.
Is being tracked and recorded.
Hey guys,
by the National Security Agency.
Let's say hello.
And
there will
be a permanent record of it.
Yeah, I make light of it.
Files.
Well, I know, like for instance, when I called, and if you're in New York, you probably are familiar with Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Right.
And that they were involved in a lot of the cases with the Guantanamo inmates, and I just assumed not that there was any electronic monitoring, but probably every call that went in there was being given strict attention. So, but in a way, okay, I'm a special case, and I'm a public personality. So are you, Maureen
right.
Webb? But if everyone is being tracked, to some extent, it's like no one being tracked. They got too much information.
Exactly. And our conversation is not being tracked because of who you are and I are. In fact, the NSA is vacuuming up all calls that go through U.S. interchanges.
Oh.
And most calls in the world, many calls in the world, even if they don't have a terminus in the United States, they go through switching stations in the United States. But it's also been revealed that the NSA, which shouldn't have a mandate to spy domestically, has been also collecting domestic calls.
National Security Agency, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's keeping a permanent record of it.
Now you mentioned about England going to go to what biometric passports. Now, my passport's 10 years old, and I'm just about to get another one. Is that going to be able, when that's scanned, is that going to be able to tell them a little more information about me than previously?
I would say in the United States, where most people don't have passports, what the government has done is create new biometric driver's licenses.
Yeah, they're having.
And that potentially is even more intrusive because these driver's licenses are linked to all. They're accessible by many more agencies than they used to be, and they're also linked to all kinds of other databases that have personal information about us, and they have the biometric data identifier. So, you know, in Anglo-American countries, the idea that citizens that would have to carry ID cards on them.
Mm-hmm.
And would be subject to random police checks has been, you know, just out of the question. The idea has been floated occasionally, but it's always been shot down. It's never occurred except in wartime. But if you turn your driver's license into a de facto ID card, then what was unthinkable before becomes a reality.
Well, yeah. Now to get into the, you know, many of us go to Windsor, our neighbor to the south. If you look at the map, that's we go south to get to Canada. You can get an enhanced Michigan driver's license rather than a passport. And you're right. I think only about 20% of Americans have passports because if you're in Wyoming.
If you think of it, a driver's license is worse than like that. It's worse than having a passport like that because a driver's license is something you carry with you all the time. And American courts have upheld random searches of identity of driver's licenses. So, you know.
Well, when if you look internationally and just sort of within our direct European frame of reference, which I know this doesn't include everybody in the States or in Canada, but say in Britain during the IRA campaign to get the British out of Northern Ireland or the Palestinian bombing campaign against Israel,
mm-hmm.
That the citizenry, and we're back to what I had initially said, they're almost people are almost willing to be willing to be subjected to anything, and certainly they're willing to subject the people who are potentially the greatest have the greatest chance of being coming from the perpetrator group.
Right. Yeah. Better than us. But I would disagree with you because most democratic societies have dealt with the threat of terrorism as a criminal matter.
Sure.
So, you know, England with the Irish IRA and Spain with the Basques and Germany with the Red Brigade, you know, it's been treated as a criminal law enforcement matter. And I would suggest, you know, this is going to be fairly controversial, but in societies which have that aren't quite as geographically isolated as the United States, you know, the population has, I think, a better perspective on the variety of risks that face them day to day. If you look at the statistics for terrorism, the number of people killed worldwide by terrorism is infinitesimal compared to, say, the number of people that are killed by car accidents. You know, and so
or U.S. wars, for instance,
or U.S.
Yeah.
wars.
I mean, both.
Not to be too controversial there. I just say, you know, why is it that in North America we have we expect our governments to be able to guarantee our safety, where in no other situation that we face do we expect the same thing? Not in worker safety, not in road safety, not in ordinary criminal law matters, which, you know, there's far more murders that happen just from ordinary criminal activity, and not from, you know, the number of people that die from lack of health care each year. And yet this infinitesimal number that faces us in North America. I mean, I think from 2004 to 2007, state reports, excluding car bombings in Iraq and Afghanistan, reported that there were 800 deaths from terrorism around the world.
Worldwide.
And
that's
all kinds of, you know, terrorist groups, not just Al-Qaeda and the ones that we've been preoccupied with.
You know,
so why, in all other situations that we face, we don't expect a guarantee of absolute safety. And yet when it comes to terrorism, we're willing to spend so many resources and give up so many of our own freedoms and give over so much control to government. Because remember, these initiatives might be used against, you know, American Muslims and Muslims from other countries right now, but they give enormous power to governments, powers of social control that at any other time in history can be used to target other groups.
Mm-hmm. And also, we, particularly in this situation, we should look at the cause of the anger. It doesn't mean that one gives in the way manner that people talk about or surrender to people that are perpetrating violence against us. But
no,
if we ended U.S. Involvement in the Middle East and in Central Asia, we would certainly go a long way towards taking out the anger. I mean, there is no excuse whatsoever from targeting civilian populations.
No.
And yet, this young man, the Times Square bomber, essentially said, hey, you're bombing my cities, I'm bombing yours. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's no excuse.
No, it's no excuse. But look at the contrast between the level of risk that we feel justified in imposing on Pakistani civilians that might be wrongly killed by the drone attacks. I think the number is up to 12,000 now, mm-hmm. of innocent Pakistanis, nothing to do with terrorism, who have been killed, compared to our toleration of any risk whatsoever.
We are completely out of time, and there's so much here, and the issues are so controversial. I want to thank you, mm-hmm. Maureen Webb, for your observations. Best source for more of this is Maureen Webb's book, Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. You go to citylights.com. There'll be a link to it also on my site, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Thanks again for being on the broadcast.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
101 WRIF.
Hi, this is Mark Schmeiss from Creed.
Hey, everybody, this is Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters.
Hey, it's Casey.
This is Chad.
This is Chris.
This is Brian from Tavo.
And you've got it on Detroit's rock station, 101 WRIF. The Riff.
That rocks. Detroit's rock station, 101 The Riff.
Okay. Look at those numbers.
Woo! Look at those numbers! Yeah! Can you believe we get paid to do this? It's only Monday! It's only Monday!
Excited about what you do? Well, pass it on. As a Junior Achievement volunteer, you can bring your enthusiasm to the classroom and give a few kids a little something extra to get excited about their future. Share a little something of yourself. Be a JA volunteer.
For information on how you can get involved, log on to JA.org.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronix Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronix is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees, having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
When I do it, I feel the blood rushing through me. My muscles tighten, and I keep going back for more.
Carmen Castillo is under the influence of Dana, her volunteer trainer.
Come on, Carmen, again.
By spending one day a week in the gym,
tuck your chin, Carmen.
Dana helps neighborhood kids like Carmen develop interests that keep them away from drugs.
Hey, let me see your shoulder shift. Jab, jab. Great.
Be a coach, a mentor, a volunteer. No matter what it is, you have something to offer.
Cool workout, Carmen. See you next week.
Log on to helpyourcommunity.org or call 877-KIDS-313 and be an influence on the kids in your community. Brought to you by the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Ad Council.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Boy, I've always been fascinated by the Beats. Man, those literary rebels of the 40s and 50s that had such an impact on the 60s. And you may recall that a couple of years ago, I think it was, maybe not that long ago, I will ask our guest. Bill Morgan was my guest, and I talked to him about his book. I Celebrate Myself, The Somewhat Private Life of Allen Ginsberg, the amazing Beat poet, and also Howl on Trial. Howl was a poem that Allen Ginsberg wrote in 1957. The prosecutors in San Francisco arrested Lawrence Ferland Getty, who ran a bookstore in San Francisco, and said it was obscene. That was an incredible book. I look at it every once in a while, almost good for humor when you see the prosecutors' claims against it. Now, of course, one of the world's most famous poems. Well, Bill Morgan has a brand new book. It's called The Typewriter is Holy. Yeah, that's what I said. The Typewriter is Holy. We'll let you know why that is. The subtitle is The Complete Uncensored History of the Beat Generation. And Bill Morgan is the author and editor of more than a dozen books about beat writers, probably knows more about the beat writers. And did they have a movement? We'll ask about that as well. For close to 40 years, he's worked as an editor and archival consultant with nearly every member of the beat generation. And let me name some of those, because that may remind you of who some of these people are. If you don't, Allen Ginsberg, Lawrence Ferland Getty, who I mentioned, Jack Kerouac, of course, On the Road, Gary Snyder, Michael McClure, Diane DePrima, Gregory Corso, William S. Burroughs, and Edie Kerouac. He lives in Vermont. We're reaching him at his home. Bill Morgan, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, Peter. It's great to be here.
Now, let me ask you, maybe I hope I'm not treading on a toe right at the beginning. Your book is under 300 pages, yet it says The Complete Uncensored History of the Beat Generation. Is that tongue-in-cheek at all?
Well, it's meant to be something that people can pick up and actually read. I think my last few books have been 500 and 600-page
right.
books. And you kind of needed help to list them. So the idea was to be concise and also to be an introduction to the entire Beat Generation. Surprisingly, as much as people know about the Beat Generation, there hasn't been an overview of the whole movement. There have been dozens of biographies of different people and even four or five different encyclopedias. But there hasn't been this overview, and that was my idea, was to give people an introduction to it.
Well, remind us what the Beat Generation was, because generations are frequently named, this was the Beat Generation. We talk about the Beats, we hear Beatnik. Maybe go for both of them, the Beat Generation and Beatniks. That's the Maynard Krebs of the 60s, and people that wear, now the Beatniks were called people that by the 60s that wore their hair long. But give us the etymology of the word beat and beatnik.
Yeah, it began with Jack Kerouac sitting down with a friend over a couple of drinks, talking about what to call their generation. And this was in the mid-1940s. And I think Jack had the idea that everyone in his generation was beat. And by that, at the time, he meant beaten down by the war, beaten down by being physically tired of going through the war, and beaten down by society, which was demanding that everyone conform to that get a job, raise a family, certainly don't think about being a poet and roaming around the country. So he used that term, and then a few years later, the person he had been talking to used it in print in the New York Times, and that was John Cleland Holmes. But at that time, they were thinking it was a worn-out group of people. As time went by, the media picked up the term Beat Generation, and everyone then had their own different definition. So it gets a little dicier then, and even Kerouac redefined it several times, and at the end of his life, he was saying it meant beatific. It was a blessed generation.
Before we get to, let me interrupt you, Bill Morgan, before we get on to beatnik, which is kind of a goofy word, which I'm anxious to hear what you have to say about it. But, you know, actually, the post-war era, or is this just more the historical mythology, this was the period of Pax Americana. It was American triumphalism. It was, you know, the suburbs were burgeoning. The white-collar man in the gray flannel suit predominated. And was it really beat other than these kind of isolated, what used to be called bohemians?
Right. Well, see, I think Jack was talking about his own group of friends, the people that surrounded him. It wasn't the entire generation like today we refer to a Generation X or a me generation as being millions of people. I think he was talking really about a group of 100 or 200 people.
Huh. Well, tell us about Beatnik, that because that, well, I would give it away if I said any more.
Right. Well, when Jack named it in the 1940s, they were all writing books, but the books hadn't been published. But as their books were published, they became famous, especially through the few court trials that that tried them for censorship. They won those cases, but they became famous, and the media picked up on the Beat Generation or the Beats. And one reporter in San Francisco, Herb Kane, was sitting around, and he was thinking about, this was in 1958, and he was thinking about something witty that he could put together. And Sputnik had just been blasted off into space. And so he combined the word beat with the end of Sputnik and called them beatniks, because both of these things were really far out, man.
Remind us what Sputnik was, though.
Oh, that's for anyone my age, they certainly remember. But for younger people, that was the very first satellite that was shot into space by the Russians. And as a kid, I can remember going out into the yard to watch this thing passing overhead, a blinking light. It was just amazing that anyone could shoot anything into space.
And it's interesting. Well, that's a Russian suffix, because you hear like refuseniks, or is that maybe that's just a made-up English word as well? But I'm not sure exactly. I probably knew at one time what Sputnik meant, but yeah. So and the Beats, the Kerouacs and the Ginsbergs and the Ferlinghettis, they despised the term, didn't they?
Well, yeah, it was used for jokes and as a derogatory term. So they didn't like to be associated with that. And it also had more to do with the lifestyle of some of the bohemians then, which really didn't characterize people like Jack Kerouac or William Burroughs.
Now, well, I shouldn't reintroduce you. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. Bill Morgan is my guest. The Typewriter is Holy is the name of the book. The subtitle, The Complete Uncensored History of the Beat Generation. And it is published by Simon & Schuster. You can go to simonandschuster.com and look it up by title. There'll be a link on my site, Peter Werby, werbe.com. Well, maybe we should actually even define who we're talking about here. Mostly when we think of, if people are familiar, and I think probably most of the listeners are, with the Ginsbergs and the Kerouacs and the Burroughs, we think of them in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, and yet they began as sort of precocious teenagers, didn't they?
Right, that's true, except for Burroughs was a little older than the others. But everyone else was in their late teens or early 20s when they met. And they met around Columbia University, for the most part, where they were students, became friends, and then became famous together.
Yeah, and you said that we usually talk about the beat movement as being a literary movement or tradition, but you don't like that phrase, the beat literary movement.
Yeah, my thesis is that they weren't so much a literary movement, and that's because none of them wrote in the same style. So when you think of something like a movement of Cubism or Dadaism, Surrealists, they are all working in the same way. In fact, I can't tell some of those Picasso paintings from Braque paintings. They look so much alike. But the Beats were a group of friends who happened to be writers. But each one of them wrote in a different way. Burroughs wrote in a completely different way than Ginsberg or Corso or Kerouac. So I don't, my idea is that it wasn't a literary movement. It was a social movement, a collection of friends who happened to be writers.
Yeah, they had an enormous impact on the generation after them, the generation of the 1960s. I don't know if there is there a name for that, the rebellious generation or something like that. But I was even thinking William Burroughs had a book, The Soft Machine, and there was a rock group called The Soft Machine. But the influence that the Beats had on the next generation was incredible. Could you outline that a little?
Oh, yeah, that was it. The 50s, when they were writing, they were almost alone in what they were doing. But during the 60s, more and more young people picked up on their books. And I think especially Jack Kerouac's On the Road, they found the book, they went on the road themselves, they had adventures, they experimented with drugs and rock and roll. And those were the kind of things that helped popularize the movement, so that by the late 60s, which I think the period is just called the 60s, when you mention that, people know what you're talking about.
You're right.
Most young people in America knew about the Beats and adopted some of the things that they believed were their lifestyles.
Now, the greatest generation, they didn't appreciate either the Beats or what they spawned in the 1960s, did they?
No, I think that they wanted to come home from the war and do the settling down, do the raising the family, have a quiet life. But unfortunately, they also gave then power to the Senator McCarthy's and the people like that who weren't quite in the American vein.
Now, they actually had a range of politics. Since their lifestyle was rebellious, one thinks of them as being having politics from the left. Certainly, Allen Ginsberg was involved in anti-war demonstrations and any number of free speech fights, and towards even to the end of his life was sympathetic to liberal and left causes. But did that characterize all of them?
No, not at all. And that's another reason that it's hard to talk about them as a group of anything but friends, because Jack Kerouac, maybe the most famous of the Beats, was also the most conservative. And he was a staunch Catholic who went to Mass every day. During the Vietnam War, he favored the American involvement there. You can't get any further away from Allen Ginsberg at the time than that, although they still remained close friends during that period.
Did they argue at all about that? Was this did they discuss it?
Yes, it was a troubling time for Allen especially, but Kerouac did argue about it, and sometimes almost violently. William Burroughs, on the other hand, wasn't interested in either side. He was removed from it. He was in Europe and North Africa, not interested in politics or spirituality, really, at all. But Jack was interested in Catholicism. Allen became interested in Buddhism and Eastern spiritualism.
Sure, he'd appeared at a number of times in Ann Arbor for the Jewel Heart Center, which is located in Ann Arbor, which is a famous Buddhist center here in our area.
That's right. He went on a lot of retreats there with Gelug Rinpoche as the instructor there.
I remember him discussing with this center leader who you just mentioned about what was the thought one should have in their mind at the moment of death. I thought, wow, I mean, this is in front of an audience of about 5,000, you know. This was
that's Yes, I think Alan spent his entire life preparing for the moment of his death. As odd as it sounds, I think that was the underlying reason for all of his studying, even all of his drug taking.
Did he go quietly into that dark night?
He did, and he did have a Buddhist death. He was surrounded. Gelug Rinpoche, the same teacher, came to his house as he was dying, and they chanted Buddhist mantras, and he did go out as a Buddhist, but a peaceful death.
Bill Morgan, your book, The Typewriter is Holy, The Complete Uncensored History of the Beat Generation, published by Simon & Schuster. You knew almost every one of these guys, didn't you?
Yeah, I was lucky in that way. I came along just at the time that Neil Cassidy and Jack Kerouac passed away, so I never met them.
What year was that?
That was in 68 and 69. Kerouac passed away in 69. Yeah. And so I didn't meet them, but I did have the good fortune of meeting all the others and working with them. In fact, someone from your area, Edie Kerouac Parker, who was Jack Kerouac's first wife, I worked with her on a few projects and edited her memoirs about her life with Jack.
Did he ever live in Grosse Pointe, Michigan? I mean, that's where she was, right?
Well, you know, he got married. He was just a kid, too, and he got married, and they went to Grosse Pointe to live with her parents for about a month. And Jack just wasn't cut out for married life or living with the in-laws, and so he left after that. But he came back to visit Grosse Pointe quite a few times in his life, and I think he was very fond of the Detroit area.
We'll claim him. I said those guys, and then immediately we began talking about Edie Kerouac. It was mostly a guy scene, wasn't it?
It really was, and Edie was not an exception. They were very much a product of their times in that way. Very liberated in many ways, but I think to most of them, a woman's job was to stay at home, cook, raise the kids, and take care of the men who were out writing poetry.
Almost misogynist in some cases, hey? Would you say that's fair?
I would say it's fair in a couple of the cases, like William Burroughs.
Yeah,
and that's, the thing where Lawrence Ferlinghetti, very liberated in his views towards women, but William Burroughs, just the opposite.
Well, I was thinking about more about Kerouac and his famous book, On the Road. Do you discuss it all in your book, The Typewriter is Holy, about I guess it's pretty much a mythology that he sat down and wrote On the Road, his famous On the Road novel, in just one sitting on this huge roll of rice paper and turned it in with no punctuation?
It's true and it's false. And the true part is he did sit down, and in the course of 3 weeks, he typed an enormous scroll, which was one paragraph, one sentence, no punctuation, which was On the Road. Now, the true story is that he had been working on that book for years and years and years before he sat down in that burst of energy and wrote it front to back. But he did do that feat in mostly sitting in a bathroom with the typewriter on his lap.
Now, they've recently released, over the last few years, the original edition without the paragraphs and what have you, but it didn't arrive as a novel like that. It was re-edited. Can you tell us that story and how? Let me just maybe, since I have the book, maybe I should just shape it a little more for the listening audience. Here's a book. When you open it up, there's no paragraphs, and it's this fair-sized novel about being on the road, these manic travels of these bohemians across America in the 40s and the early 50s. But somehow it wound up, when it was finally published, with paragraphs and what have you. How did Kerouac deal with all that?
Well, that's right. You can imagine Kerouac took that scroll out of the typewriter, 100 and some feet long, and put it under his arm and went to his publisher and put it on the desk. Well, the publisher didn't know what to think of it. He had never seen anything like that. I don't know that he even read it, but he gave it back to Jack and said, in this form, we can't do anything with it. So Jack, with the help of an editor, broke it up into paragraphs, into what we would consider a more traditional format.
Did he resent that? Did he resent having to do that?
Yes, he did. He did it because he was just starting out and was hoping for publication. But as the years went by, he put in his contract that no punctuation at all could be changed without his approval. I'm sure he drove countless editors crazy.
Yeah, it's actually difficult to read in some ways, but you get that manic flow, certainly. And it has this almost breath of the book On the Road has this breathless quality to it. These people always in motion, to the point where I'm at a point in my life, I felt like when I was reading it, I felt like saying, guys, take it easy. But they never took it easy, did they?
No. And that all came through this man named Neil Cassidy, who he was filled with energy. And when he talked, he would talk nonstop, I think hour after hour, without even pausing for a breath. And Jack got the idea of writing the way Neil Cassidy talked. No punctuation, just start the story and just go on for 100 pages. And when you get to the end, you're at the end. Put in a period.
Now, the original manuscript of On the Road also named the actual names of Jack Kerouac's friends, the Ginsbergs and the Neil Cassidy and all that. But that got changed as well for fictional characters, right?
Right. Well, that was a problem with getting by the lawyers, because they felt that you couldn't write about actual people without their permission. And then there were some questions about whether he could get the permission of everyone he wrote about. So he changed the names. But nowadays, everyone knows who the characters are. There are quite a few articles that list the actual name and the pseudonym of the characters. So it's pretty well known.
Let's go back to them sort of as a group. As you said, that they weren't a homogenous group. Some of them were gay, some of them were straight. Allen Ginsberg, probably the most famous of the gay members of that circle of friends. And this was an era. I mean, a lot of these guys were pretty macho, particularly beginning with Kerouac, but they were accepting.
That's right. Well, Jack was very liberal in some ways, and in accepting his friends, he was tremendously liberal. And he was a star football player, a handsome athlete who could have any woman that he wanted, and had quite a few of them, I think. But it was a time when this group formed together as friends, and they didn't look at each other as, oh, he's the queer, or oh, he's the macho football player. They saw themselves as writers and friends. But again, it was a big group of people, and they all had different personalities and different interests in that way.
Well, the Beat Generation friends go back to the 1940s, yet a number of them are still with us. Lawrence Ferlinghetti is, Gary Snyder, Michael McClure, Diane DePrima. It's they're getting up there. I know Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Isn't he in his late 80s by now?
He's actually 91 now.
91, and still vibrant, still running City Lights bookstore in San Francisco, or at least has a hand in it.
Right? That's right. Every day he goes into the office and does his work, and then he goes to the studio and paints and exercises. He's a great role model for anyone. He's very active, and he'll live to be 150.
If someone asked me, if I was you, Bill Morgan, someone said to me, why are you so fascinated by the Beat Generation? I guess I would say because they're fascinating. That's why the lives they led. How do you feel?
Yeah, well, that is a good answer. I hadn't thought of that, but that's how I'll answer it from now on. I think because there is such a wide range of people, some of the ones that I knew I didn't really care for personally and loved their writing, and others that I liked, maybe I didn't care for their writing as much, but there's a lot to choose from.
Was it, I think, this must have been quite a few years ago, I saw Michael McClure, who was pretty young. He was hanging out with the Beats when he was in his teens. The guys were a lot older, and he did performances, poetry performances with Ray Manzarek of the Doors.
That's right, and he still does that. Michael was one of the closest friends of the Doors, and Jim Morrison was a special friend of his. Jim Morrison felt that he was a poet more than a songwriter, and he and Michael McClure hung out together. Michael McClure also was friendly with a lot of the people in the Hells Angels and that group. So that wasn't typical of the Beats. You can see that's another kind of offshoot, but still very much one of those original Beat figures.
Well, this is, actually, I was just looking at the clock. We only have about 2 minutes left. I was going to bring up the famous confrontation with that the anti-war movement had, I think it was like in 1966 or something out in the Bay Area, where with the Hell's Angels, who were opposed to the anti-war movement. Allen Ginsberg cooled out the Hell's Angels. Amazing man. Is there a way to rank order who is the most amazing of these figures?
Oh, no, I wouldn't want to do that. I think you have to look at them all and select the one whose writing you like the best, and then that would be the one that amazes you the most.
You know, actually, if somebody who isn't real familiar with the Beats but have heard particularly those names of Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and wanted to take your advice, Bill Morgan, about who should I start reading? Well, this is a good place to start with Bill's new book, The Typewriter is Holy, The Complete Uncensored History of the Beat Generation. Well, does that mean there's no more on the Beat Generation for Bill Morgan?
No. Later this summer, I've edited the letters of Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg back and forth, and next year a volume of William Burroughs' letters is coming out that I've edited. So there's always more.
It's amazing how meticulous they were in keeping track of themselves with their letters and their photographs. There really is a treasure trove, isn't there?
There is, and times were different. It was before the emails, and they really were traveling around the world, and they kept their friends informed about what they were doing through their letters.
Well, it's always exciting talking to you, Bill. Bill Morgan's brand new book is called The Typewriter is Holy, The Complete Uncensored History of the Beat Generation, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. You can go to their website, simonandschuster.com. There'll be a link on my website. Might be easier, because I'll have it directly to the book. Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Bill Morgan, as usual, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Do you know someone who always seems well-connected? Here's your chance to one-up that person and then some. Welcome to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, your online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses. Simply log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com for special online coupons and discounts you can't get anywhere else. This week's featured deals: Jay's Auto Detailing in Southfield, Premier Pet Supply in Beverly Hills, House of Watchbands in Southfield, and Gilbert's Pro Hardware in St. Clair Shores. All you have to do is visit MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. You'll save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your computer. Heck, you don't even have to get dressed. No shirt, no shoes, no problem.
Shot naked, man. Yeah!
Dressed or not, just go to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and you'll be connected to these incredible deals and more. MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, man. Hey, like, this chair is really cold.
Dressed or not, just go to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and you'll be connected to these incredible deals and more. MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
Woohoo! Win big at the casino?
Nope, better than that. I just got a great deal at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Ah, yes, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, the online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses.
I always look there first. They're the best bet for online coupons and discounts.
This week, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com is featuring Jay's Auto Detailing in Southfield, Premier Pet Supply in Beverly Hills, House of Watch Bands in Southfield, and Gilbert's Pro Hardware in St. Clair Shores.
Jackpot! Nobody beats MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Deal yourself a winning hand. Save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your own home when you connect to amazing deals like these and more at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
That rocks. 101 WRIF. The Riff.
Vampire.